I will call the Civil on Data Practices Committee to order. Representative Lunin, have you had the opportunity to review the minutes?
I have.
And would you like to move them?
I would like to move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lunin. Representative Lunin moves the minutes. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. The first bill on our agenda today, and we do have a full agenda, folks. If we don't get done this morning, we will come back after session this evening. Representative Davids, House File 1693. I will move House File 1693 before the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I also have a DE1 amendment, if we could move that and work off of that.
All right. I will move the DE1 amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the DE1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The DE1 is before us. Go ahead to your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. This bill is very similar to House File 5. And what this bill does is it sets up a reinsurance pool, and I won't get into the financing of it, or I won't get into the policy of the insurance part. We had that hearing yesterday on House File 5 in Commerce Committee. But what we're looking at in this committee, I was told that I would need to go to civil law, and I got so excited because I don't think I've ever been here before. What a group of all-stars we have here. So with that, if members, if you could please look on the DE1 amendment, page 7, line 7.3 and on, I believe that's what we're talking about today, to make sure that the data privacy language is written correctly here. AMSHA is going to be taking and running the reinsurance program according to the bill. And they, of course, have to have access to some data so that they can properly vet and pay claims for insureds or for the carriers as to be reinsurance for the carriers. And so I just want to make sure that this language works very well. And so with that, I would just that's what the bill does.
Are there member questions?
Well, not sure.
Representative Lush.
I know that we're here because of that one data provision component, but can I just get a sense? I don't think I've heard the bill before, so what are you proposing to do, Chair Davids?
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lush. What we're doing, and as we said in Commerce yesterday, this is a work in progress, and normally I don't say that because normally when I have a bill, that's what the bill is. This is a little different, however, because I'm working with Commissioner Rothman, the governor's office, with some different ideas on how do we do reinsurance. Now, we had House or Senate File 1 we passed was the $307 million to buy down the premium 25%. It had a few reforms there, like continuity of care. This is a piece that I was hoping would be in that bill, but this is going to take a little bit more time as far as the whole bill itself. What the bill does, and it's the commissioner gave some very good testimony in Commerce yesterday and has some ideas that we need to look at very closely. But the way the bill is written now, it says that there will be a reinsurance program, and the MSHA board, which is still in existence, would run it. And the commissioner made some very good points yesterday on how we need to maybe change the makeup of the board a little bit, because the way the board is now, there's two clients, of MSHA. Well, there won't be any clients of MSHA on there, because MSHA would be running the reinsurance pool. And what it does, the way I've written it to this point, and it's subject to working with the department on, there'd be a $50,000 attachment point on the reinsurance, and then from $50,000 to $250,000, there'd be between a 15% to 70% co-insurance within that, and then after $250,000, the claims would be on the carrier. The theory behind this bill is to take some of the pressure off of the carriers, and the theory would be if they are paying less in claims through the reinsurance model, that premiums would then go down, is what we're working for. But that the basic structure is 50,000 attachment point, then it's 50% to 70% to be determined by the board co-insurance until 250,000, and then after that it'd be on the carrier.
Okay. Left.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that explanation, Chair David. So then, am I to understand it? At some point, I mean, I assume there's a fiscal note on it then? Do we have any idea what that is?
Chair
Madam
Davis.
Chair, and yes, Representative Lesh, there would be. And that's the bill. House File 5 is headed to HHS Finance, where those items will be determined in the Finance Committee. But there's quite a few different areas. I think we're looking at probably in the area of $200 to $225 million for the reinsurance program. Now, how that's exactly going to be funded, I think in the bill it has some suggestions or ideas, but that is to be determined working with the governor's office and the House and the Senate.
Okay.
So that's not in stone at this point.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. Oh, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there's just not been a lot of testimony here. There was a lot in Commerce yesterday. This is a controversial proposal. There are different opinions on which type of reinsurance, if you do reinsurance, there should be, whether it should be a touch point or who gets the money if all of the money isn't actually spent on care for folks. And so given that civil law hasn't really had a lot of testimony, I just don't want people to get the impression that this isn't controversial. And so, members, I believe it was a pretty divided vote as well in Commerce.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, and to the Hillstrom
Chair
point,
Davids.
If it wasn't controversial, I'd really have no interest in carrying it.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Flanders, and I'm the legislative specialist with Citizens Council for Health Freedom. We're testifying today to our concerns with a few of the data provisions in House File 1693. In particular, we're concerned with the vagueness around the term data. Line 4.26 of the DE says the association must collect data from an eligible health carrier that are necessary to determine reinsurance payments according to the data requirements under Subdivision 5. But in Subdivision 5, all it says is that a health plan must provide the association with access to the data within the dedicated data environment established by the health plan under the Federal Risk Adjustment Program, which is a program of the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. We do not find any description of the data, although on line 7.5 it mentions data requirements, yet again without definition. We understand the dedicated environment is a web portal, and we know the federal government has access to this portal. So is the portal to be parsed for a variety of uses, or is this the same data file being used for different purposes? Another question, is the data in the portal the data of the plan's enrollees, or only the data of the individuals for whom the carrier is seeking a reinsurance program? The federal government enters the portal and gets access to everyone's data to do a risk assessment of the plan's entire population. The bill is silent on the data to be shared, so the public really has no idea what this language means. We also note with concern that nothing in the bill requires that individuals whose care will be funded by this new government premium security plan are told about the premium security plan, or the fact that their data will be shared with the association, which is a government-established entity, or what of their data will be shared. With MSHA, people enrolled and they knew they were in MSHA, their data wasn't going anywhere they didn't know about. With this program, it's the entire individual market. So if we understand this bill correctly, anyone could suddenly have their data shared with the government without their knowledge. Finally, a word about high risk. On line 5.12, the association board is required to ensure that the payment parameters mitigate the impact of high-risk individuals. There's no definition for that term, and it's interesting that the bill doesn't say high cost, so the language could encourage profiling. Well, thank you very much for allowing me to testify. I can stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Flanders. And my understanding, Chair Davids, of this is it's the same data that was used and collected when MSHA was in full force. Am I correct about that?
That's what I understand. I don't know if the staff could help us out with that, but I believe that to be correct. And one reason, the way MSHA used to work, the Health Conference of Health Association of Minnesota Act of 1976, basically what that did was you received your own policy. And so by receiving your own policy, you would have got information, more information about that if you had a separate policy. This is transforming MSHA into a reinsurance carrier. People are not even going to see that they have this. You're going to get a policy from Blue Cross or Medica or Health Partners or Preferred One or whoever it is, and it'll be within, you know, all the language will be within the policy itself. You won't have a separate policy as we did during the MSHA days.
Okay, thank you. Any member questions for this witness or further questions for Chair Davids?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Davids, that may be the case, one thing that we're finding out about data and its uses are having very different applications now than they did either in 1972 or even in 2002. So will you be willing to work with Mr. Flanders and other folks to make sure that if there is a risk of that data being used for purposes that we don't intend it, that would be tightened up in the language?
Chair Davids.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and Representative Lesch. It's my commitment to this committee to work on every line of this bill all along the way. This I work very closely with Commissioner Rothman and the department. That is continuing. Any interested party, 585, my number is 69278, give me a call. And we'll talk about these things, because this has to be done right, and as Commissioner Rothman said yesterday, it has to be done quickly. This needs to be done by April 1st so that there will be a market. This is a very, very serious bill, because if we don't do this, there's a very high likelihood that there will be a very limited, if any, market in 2018, if that's serious. So that's the bill overall, and I want to make sure the data issues are correct, and I'll be relying a lot on the chair and you and Representative Hillstrom and others to make sure we get it right. But data has to be shared between MSHA and the carriers so that when the carriers have a claim, it goes over to MSHA. They have to be able to verify that it's a real claim. And so we do need to make sure that the data is correct, and I will be relying heavily upon people in this committee to make sure that's right, and whoever this guy is here. What's your name again? Mr. Flanders. I'll be happy to talk to him at any time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, excuse me. I renew my motion that House File 1693 be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Regulatory Reform as amended. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
You're on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you for being here. Representative Fabian. Representative Lucero, would you like to move House File 1291? And the motion would be that it be re-referred to Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee.
So move, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. I would just have, before you get started, Representative Fabian, if we could just have nonpartisan staff direct us to the very limited reason that you're in this committee, if they could just highlight the areas of the bill that are pertinent to the oversight of this committee. We'll put you on pause there, Representative Fabian. I didn't warn them ahead of time that I was going to call on them, so they're finding the spot.
Madam Chair and members, the portion of the bill that's relevant for this committee is on page 17, lines 15 through 21.
Thank you. Representative Fabian, do you want to address that portion of the bill?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have some technical help here.
Okay.
So on page 17, lines 15 through 21, this has to do with the Environmental Quality Board having been directed a number of years ago to look for, to do a study to find out some possible locations for radioactive waste disposal. And in our bill, in this section of the bill, we are actually eliminating the EQB, the Environmental Quality Board. And what we would be doing then is moving that responsibility for this over to another agency within the state, possibly Commerce or MPCA. Energy issues are discussed frequently and handled through the Department of Commerce. So, you know, we're willing to put that responsibility basically wherever we think it would be appropriate.
All right. Did you have anybody that was here to testify?
I did.
Okay. Did they leave the room?
I'm not sure what they did. But that's okay. I think I can handle
it. Reliable testifier.
Representative Lesh.
No. You want me to testify? You should ask about this radioactive waste.
This is it's more technical thing. We're not banning. We're not doing anything different. We're just simply shifting the responsibility from the EQB to another agency within state government.
And my understanding too was that what was the issue here was what was done with the data from those, whether that waste was being transported or just what was being done with it.
And this was for a study. It wasn't for any. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Representative Fabian, go ahead.
This was for a collection of data, you know, to discuss possible sites and so forth. So it's not like things were being moved around. And, you know, they didn't move stuff up to Roseau County and dig a hole and stick it in the ground. It was simply collecting some data and getting some ideas and some possibilities. That's my understanding.
Right. And from my understanding, that data was public data. So, Representative Lesh, question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Fabian, I see the language that removes it as a responsibility of the EQB, but I don't see language that, as you suggest, transfers it over to another agency. So where is that language in the bill?
Well, in line 17.19, it talks about certain data being given to the Pollution Control Agency.
Representative Lesh?
Okay, so that's the transfer. Is the striking of the 7.19 language means it is, in fact, the PCA's responsibility now?
Representative Fabian.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, at this point, yes, that would be.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
But, again, I'm open to,
Okay. Representative Hillstrom. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hansen argued that this bill cut out the citizen participation in a time when people don't feel like they have their voice heard by government. What have you done to address the issues Representative Hansen raised in that committee? Because that is probably one of the issues that this committee would care about very much.
Sure. Representative Hillstrom, this bill's going where next? It's going to GovOps, and that's an open meeting issue, so that would be taken up there. But Representative Fabian, if you want to answer the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hillstrom. I think that back in 2011 when we had House File 1, and we've done a lot of things with environmental review and streamlining the permitting process, I'm all for trying to empower people to be involved in the processes. It's not my intention to close people out of the process. There's all kinds of availabilities for public comments to be submitted. There's hearing. You know, when there's draft permits that are available, posting them and so forth, people have an opportunity to see those. So we're not. It's not my intention to lower any standards. It's not my intention to minimize public input. That's not where I'm at. What I'm trying to do is actually even follow along with things that the EQB discussed in their February meeting, which was to try to figure out ways to streamline and expedite permitting. There's a tremendous amount of frustration in the state of Minnesota with regards to the amount of time it takes to get some of these permits, and I recognize that some of them are very complex. I fully appreciate that, and I respect that. But the amount of time and the amount of money that is spent on permitting is very frustrating to a lot of people who are trying to do some really, really good things. So, to that point, Representative Hillstrom, I want to make sure that the process continues to remain transparent and that there is public input.
Representative Hillstrom? Thank you, Madam Chair. This leads me to the second question, which was, so any time that there is a change in citizen participation, that then kind of changes the access to data. Because when citizens are participating, right, usually those are in open meetings, and then that data is available. So in the event that you do close out the citizen participation, it would be important for us to know what data changes you make so that the citizens can get access to information that they would otherwise have gotten at a public meeting. And so what do you envision if you aren't having those kinds of public meetings for the public to get access to that same kind of data?
Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's still going to be public meetings. Just because the EQB is being eliminated in this bill, It doesn't mean that we're changing the public meeting processes. The steps involved, and I've been involved in this for my six-plus years in the legislature, the steps that are currently involved, involved in permitting and environmental review, call for a tremendous amount of public meetings and public input, whether you're getting a permit from the Department of Natural Resources or MPCA or Department of Commerce. It's very structured at this point. And what we're trying to do is to continue to have public input. I think that that's important. And so we're not eliminating, you know, if we're eliminating a lot of public input into this process, that's not in the, it's not, I think it's a perception more than it is a reality. And what we're doing is we're shifting responsibilities around. I believe with all my heart that what goes on at the EQB, which is kind of a sub-agency of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, I believe that those responsibilities can be handled in the other state agencies, as they already are. I mean, when we hear reports about, well, I'll say PolyMet or Twin Metals or ethanol plant or whatever, in the news we don't hear about the Environmental Quality Board and the permits. We hear about the Pollution Control Agency and the DNR. And those are the two big ones, and that's what's going to continue.
I believe there are some testifiers. Mr. Quillis, and on deck would be Kevin Reuter. I don't know if I have that right. And if you could keep your comments to just this section that applies to our committee, that would be helpful. Good morning. Please state your name.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and was just here to answer any questions as the
okay.
Day went.
Okay. All right. Very fine. Mr. Reuter, or Reuter, okay, see in the audience? Going once, going twice, okay. Any other member questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what, you know, we're looking at 715 to 721. So does, when we strike the study data for radioactive waste disposal, does that mean that we're doing away with that study too, or we're just taking the data and it's becoming irrelevant because I don't know what happens to it because you're striking the study data.
Representative Dean, let's have, if we could have nonpartisan staff address that question, if they could do that.
Madam Chair and members, so Article 2 of this bill eliminates the EQB, eliminates some of its duties, and reassigns other of its duties. I'm not sure if this particular duty, the performing of this study, has been eliminated or reassigned under this bill.
Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dean, this was a study that was done long ago. I don't remember the exact date. I think Mr. Quillis probably has the date. In fact, he probably was involved in it as a staffer around here at the time.
Mr. Quillis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Tony Quillis from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. In Article 2, Section 2, upon the elimination of the Environmental Quality Board, one of the issues was how to go through. They are the ones tasked right now with dealing with low-level radioactive waste, and I'm going to date myself here, Madam Chair. This goes back to what's called the Midwest Low-Level Radioactive Waste Compact, where the federal government asked states to go through and do some exploratory drilling and provide availability for the capacity to dispose of low-level radioactive waste, 1985. And I was on staff because one of the folks that I was working for, his district, was targeted to be one of the 13 sites in the state where they were going to do some exploratory drilling. And so that's what this data, when all that hydraulic and geological drilling was going to go on, where that data went. So we're trying to make sure that stays in place and that's all applicable. And according to staff, the how to go through and do that is to take that data and under 116C840, still make it available to the public if any of this happened. it's my opinion that it's obsolete right now. I don't think there's anybody doing that right now or anybody that's even thinking about doing it. But at the time, under this Midwest Interstate Low-Level Radioactive Waste Compact, that's what where that data was.
Representative Dean, follow-up?
No, Madam Chair. Okay. I'm just trying to wrap my head around this. And if this data, if it's a bunch of geological data and things like that, if that's accessible to the public, I, you know, God knows what they, some people could decide to do with that data.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Manager. Mr. Quillis, what is low-level radioactive waste? I mean, that's, is this the, is this dry cast storage? Is this medical waste? Is this the, my kid's three-month-old lunch that's been sitting in the drawer of the fridge for, I mean, what is it? Where does it
Mr.
come
Quillis?
From?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I wish I could define it for you. I don't have the definition right in front of me, but I think it would be more towards the latter than it would towards the former. Radioactive waste is regulated under Department of Commerce and Public Utilities Commission.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd really like to get a better idea of what we're talking about for low-level radioactive waste. Maybe I shouldn't be worried about it, but someone in this room knows what they're talking about.
I see someone from the MPCA is here. If they would be willing to come down and address that question, if they know the answer. I do think this is addressing a study that was done in the 80s, and it's really, this could have been part of the UN-session a few years ago where this could have probably been taken out of statute to a certain extent, because I don't think anything's being done currently. Representative Fabian?
And, Madam Chair, back to the comments from Mr. Quillis, this goes back to the mid-80s. It's a collection of data. You know, so what's happened with that data, I don't think that there's been a lot of decisions that I'll defer to Ms. Gauthier. Maybe she knows.
Ms. Gauthier, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead if you know the answer to the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Greta Gauthier. I'm the Legislative Director at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I do not have the definition of low-level radioactive waste available with me right now. We do, the MPCA does, per state statutes established by the legislature, regulate hazardous waste and toxic waste in Minnesota. So we do, I'm sure we have a definition for it in statute. I don't have it in front of me at this moment.
Well, Madam Chair, even without a definition, I'm just wondering who produces low-level radioactive waste. So my best guess would be a you know, medical provider that's running CAT scans, or I have no idea who are the primary producers of low-level radioactive waste.
Ms. Gauthier.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, I do know that some medical waste does have low-level radioactivity to it. You're right. Beyond that, I don't have with me the information, but certainly I'm guessing chemical laboratories, possibly other types of manufacturing. It may be the watch that is in your child's desk drawer. But I'd have to get back to you on that, and I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. I'd be curious, and I think Representative Fabian might have an idea.
Representative Fabian?
I have an idea, Madam Chair. It's amazing what you can find out. This waste typically consists of contaminated protective shoe covers, clothing, wiping rags, mops, filters, reactor water treatment residues, equipment, tools, luminous dials, medical tubes, swabs, injection needles, syringes, laboratory animal carcasses, and tissues.
Okay.
Ooh, laboratory animal carcasses. There's
excellent.
A nice one for us. Thank you, Ms. Gauthier.
Okay, thank you.
Any other member questions? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? See someone coming forward? Please introduce yourself for the take and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Bob Tamman from Sudan, Minnesota. A couple miles away from Tower Sudan, like the little Twin Cities up there. and as I listen to this debate about the EQB, I'm trying to think of what it means to the average citizen. And most of us are not too familiar, but we use quite a bit of electricity up there. And 5 or 6 years ago, the power company wanted to put through a power line right on the south edge of Tower. They brought in their surveying crew. They staked out the right-of-way, and somebody noticed it's going through a grove of old-growth cedar. Now, to those of you who follow Minnesota's environmental issues, we're having trouble regenerating cedar. I think it's a problem with deer and one thing or another, but cedar is important. So,
Mr. Hammond,
yes.
I appreciate you being here today, but we're focusing just on this one section of the bill in the Civil Law Committee. This isn't, I think, I mean,
this,
I'll give you some gravity, but what it sounds like you're headed is really more appropriate for the Environment Committee, but I'll give you a little more levity here.
This is, Madam Chair, this is about the Environmental Quality Board, and the first thing a bunch of us stakeholders did is file a little petition and fire it into the Environmental Quality Board.
Right, and does that have anything to do with Section 17.15 through 17.21? I understand you're addressing the Environmental Quality Board, and that's what this overall bill does, but in the committee process, this bill stopped to civil law just for this one section. So if you could keep your comments to that one section, that would be great. If they're not to this section, I would just ask you to comment in the committee that's appropriate for that.
I believe removal of an Environmental Quality Board eliminates a possibility for citizens to successfully solve environmental differences without lawyering up. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much.
Chair, can I ask, why is that section the only section that is the purview of this committee when there's all kinds of data that could be implicated by this bill? Why was the decision made that that's the only section that we're looking at?
Representative Lesh, do you have specific sections that you're looking at?
Well, no. I mean, there's with the elimination of the EQB, there's all, and Representative Hillstrom brought this up too. That was kind of a broad characterization of it. But there's even a narrower characterization of the implications on availability of public data. And I realize the decision by the chair to limit testimony to a certain section is spitballing it to a certain extent. I've done that too. But I just was trying to get a sense of why the decision was made that it came to this committee for this section specifically. Why was that?
Because this dealt with data. It's Chapter 13. This section is referenced to Chapter 13.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Well, Madam Chair, just to point out, the House Rule 4.06 does not limit this committee's consideration just to Chapter 13. It says that everything involving public data should come here. And I the definition is a little squishy on that, I get, but a lot of these citizens are coming up and raising claims, and the only way they have the ability to raise a claim is if public data is available to question. So I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Fabian, or Chair Fabian, I think you already addressed this in your previous comments, but it is not your intent to keep any information that is currently public away from the public in the future with this change. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I just want to talk about the repealers a little bit, because actually on page 3R of the repealer section, it actually is repealing the board's ability to enter and enforce stipulation agreements and to make and enforce statutes and rules administered by the board. And I think that's clearly within this jurisdiction of this committee, and I'm still looking at the rest of the repealers to see if there's anything else that I'm missing.
Can I ask in light of that?
Representative Lesh.
So the elimination of statewide nitrate data, water assessments and reports, eminent domain actions, are those transferred in additional language in this bill specifically to another agency like the PCA or someone else's? Maybe there's staff who can answer that.
Representative Fabian, do you know the answer to that?
Madam Chair, it would certainly be my intention that would be the case, yes. There would be, it would be transferred. Okay, it's not going to just disappear.
Okay. Representative Lesh.
Well, just to be clear, I mean, if that's the intent, there's a lot. Just like in that one section, we're eliminating this, and then that's your intention that it gets moved over. And I believe you, Representative Fabian, but sometimes things happen fast around bill deadlines around here. I want to make sure that's the case.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other section I want to draw your attention to is 4R, the section on legal and technical assistance to Indian tribes. I want to make certain that that, of course, would be something that the civil law would also care about. You're just moving it. You're not eliminating it. On page 4R, it's 116C.722, legal and technical assistance to Indian tribes.
Representative Hillstrom, to back up to the 3R, I believe that the reference you made before was in reference to the board, and that board won't exist any longer, but I will let the staff answer the questions on the repealer sections that were alluded to.
So Madam Chair, what I want to make sure is that if we're repealing the section because the board doesn't exist, I want to make sure that someone has the enforcement of statute and rules that used to be at the board, and that someone has legal and technical assistance to Indian tribes, right? I just want to make sure that if it used to exist in statute, I want to make sure that it doesn't cease to exist.
Mm-hmm. Right. Ms.
Mullen? Chair and members, I do not know the answer to whether or not the legal and technical assistance for Indian tribes continues if the board goes away. So that would be a question for the author or somebody who has worked on redrafting this. Technically, that statute is referring to the duties of the board and what the board needs to do. So that would be something typically as a agency duty, that would be the kind of thing that would be discussed in government operations or state government. If that helps.
Representative Fabian, that's obviously a concern of members on the committee, so if you want to make sure, I know this bill is moving to GovOps, so.
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, we did have a short discussion about this in our Environment Committee when we introduced the bill there, and it was made pretty clear that we are in no way trying to eliminate any assistance to the tribes and so forth. So as we move forward with this, it's my commitment to make sure that continues.
Any other member questions? If not, all those in favor of Representative, who did that? Lucero renews his motion that 1291 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations and Elections Policy. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
You're on your way, Representative Fabian. Thank you for
Madam
being
Chair,
here.
Committee members, appreciate your time.
Representative O'Driscoll, House File 593. Representative Howe, would you like to move House File 593, and the motion is that it's on its way to the General Register?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Howe. Good morning, Representative O'Driscoll.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Civil Law Committee. The bill that we have before us, House File 593, has nothing to do with reinsurance, has nothing to do with low-level radiation. It has to do with appraisal-related standards here in the state of Minnesota. On an annual basis, the Minnesota Appraisers form a working group with stakeholders, and this bill represents the work that they've done in the off-season. And it has been through the Commerce Committee and is being referred here for, I believe, and I will check with nonpartisan staff, but I believe Section 4 is the section that is in the purview of this committee. I could be wrong with my section number, but the entire bill is not within the purview of the Civil Law Committee. And with that, I can also tell you that we've been working in consultation with the Department of Commerce, and they are also okay, and we do have a representative from Commerce here if needed to provide testimony. And I have with us from the working group Mr. Byron Miller, who will do a walkthrough and be available to answer questions that the committee may have.
All right,
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Miller, would you like to go ahead with testimony?
excuse me. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Byron Miller. I'm an appraiser, and I am the chair of the Government Relations Committee of the North Star Chapter of the Appraisal Institute. I'll just give you a quick overview of the three items in our bill. The first one has to do with a minor change in what constitutes an investigation. This was an issue that affected our membership. It had to do with some folks being denied insurance and getting turned down from work based on the definition of what constitutes an investigation. So we're actually just kind of wordsmithing this a little bit, changing some verbiage to please some, for instance, the errors and omissions insurance providers and some of the appraisal management companies that employ appraisers and insure them. The second item has to do with background checks. We are requesting that we make a change. Currently, the background checks, as are implemented in law, are based on the appraiser qualification board, or the AQB, not to be confused with the AQB that the gentleman was talking about in the previous bill. The AQB is a it's a federally mandated board that enforces, or actually not enforces, but how should I say, it oversees licensing requirements to the state regulatory bodies with regards to appraisal standards and qualifications. And we are requesting that we come back in line with the new set of standards as stated in, I believe it was February of 2015. And then the third item has to do with the statute of limitations. In a nutshell, this has to do with we have the equivalent on a national level of what are called the mortgage trolls. They're going after appraisers that have been involved with maybe a loan that got foreclosed on maybe as long as 15 to 20 years ago. And our ethics, our appraisal ethics, require that we keep our reporting files for 5 years. So we're trying to actually just create a separate silo so individuals such as myself do not have to lawyer up when there's an allegation against us, simply because most of the appraisers in Minnesota are like myself. There are one person or a small shop, and you know, when you have to defend an allegation, especially something going back farther than we are required by the feds for our record keeping law, could be devastating. So, kind of in a nutshell, that's.
Madam Chair,
thank you, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you want to defer to nonpartisan staff, I do believe, like I said, Section 4 is that data retention portion. That's really germane to the committee. Mr. Miller was kind of backgrounding. Some members have a general idea of what the bill does as it pertains to the section before the committee.
Right. Chair O'Driscoll, there's several provisions in here that apply to civil law. The statute of limitations would fall under our purview, and the background checks as well.
Sure.
So kind of there's a lot in this bill that pertains to our committee, but I will have staff, nonpartisan staff, address those issues.
Chair and members, you kind of hit on it. The Section 1 pertains to the data related to real estate appraisers. Section 3 with the criminal records checks also have is under the purview of this committee. And Section 5 has the statute of limitations for civil causes of action related to appraisal services. So those would all be in this committee.
Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I'll open it up to member questions. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe this would probably be to the bill author. If you look at page 2, line 2.14, it talks about any crimes involving moral turpitude. Could you explain what that means?
Representative O'Driscoll, you can feel free to phone a friend up here if you'd like. If you don't
I will. I guess before I phone a friend, I want to know which friend I should be phoning. If Representative Dean could, is he looking for the definition of moral turpitude, or is he asking how it might apply in this particular profession?
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, both.
See, I should have only asked one question. I got to answer two. What I would like to do is to bring down the Department of Commerce representative, if I could. Mr. Brickwitty was here, said he would be here, is not here. At the current time, the deputy commissioner.
Oh, there he is.
Oh, there he is. He moved over to the other side of the room. Mr. Brickley might be able to talk about it. It's a standard that's used within regulated industries, which is in the purview of commerce.
Very fine. Oh. Yeah, turpitude is not a word that we throw around
a lot these days.
Speaking out a word, Madam Chair, on the calendar of the day, you're correct.
Right.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Brickwoody, welcome.
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwoody from the Department of Commerce. Madam Chair, I'm not an attorney, so I don't have a legal definition of what moral turpitude means. I think the intention here is for a renewal applicant to disclose to the commissioner as part of the application process if they have been convicted of any crimes that would be related to the or be of concern to the regulatory agency in the course of the conduct of their work. So something related to fraud or a financial situation that would potentially be of interest to the public in the event that the appraiser was operating in an individual's home or business. But I would defer to counsel, again, Madam Chair, not being an attorney, I don't have a legal definition of that particular term.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwoody. Representative Dean, you're going to defer to Representative Lesh. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dean, moral turpitude is a legal concept in the United States and some other countries that refers to an act or behavior that gravely violates the sentiment or accepted standard of the community. So this is pretty common. I was familiar with it when I was doing some immigration law about 1,000 years ago. And it's the standard by which we decide whether or not we're going to deport someone, but it's also used in some instances in regulatory contexts where it's a line of demarcation between, yeah, you shoplifted, but it's not a crime of moral turpitude. So it's standard. Typically, it would be like assault, a sexual assault, stealing huge amounts of money, things like that. Not low-level crimes, essentially.
Representative Hilstrom, we're going to have a discussion between the attorneys on the,
here we go.
The finer points of this. Let's move it along, folks. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it can be a low-level offense. It's just certain types. So, like, the actual theft usually is considered a crime of moral turpitude, but, like, receiving stolen property, kind of the very same act, if you actually didn't take it, might not be considered that. And it doesn't necessarily matter what the level of offense is. It just is about the type. So, like, certain kinds of drugs might be a crime of moral turpitude. Certain kinds of convictions would be considered it and not others. It really is kind of a term of art, and many immigration lawyers spend many, many years drawing those lines and figuring out whether this is going to get their client deported or not. And that's kind of where that term comes from. It's not a real clear term, and I'm not a real fan of using it in law, but I would encourage you all to Google it, because there's actually a PDF document from the federal government where you can see what's in it and what's not.
Thank you. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. So to be clear, and I stated, you know, assault would be a crime of moral turpitude, and a fifth-degree assault is a misdemeanor, right, maximum. So, yeah, that's technically a low-level crime, but it's seen as worse than a lot of other misdemeanors like driving without a license. I can see a lot of people's eyes in here are rolling in the back of their heads on this, so I'll just leave it at that.
Representative Dean.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So it would then be up to Department of Commerce or the board that oversees the appraisers to sort of interpret exactly what that means?
Chair O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I did not define moral turpitude, although I do professionally train on these different topics that are before the committee. When we talk about moral turpitude, what we're talking about, and we talk to licensees about, is behavior unbecoming. And it might be, as was discussed here, different activities that aren't directly germane to the practice, but it might be you assaulted a client. That's something that's unbecoming to a professional. And you may see that in different kinds of professions. To the question, Representative Dean, in the state of Minnesota, the jurisdiction of licensure is the Department of Commerce. They're the regulatory authority, so they would review Chapter 82B, which is the appraisal statutes and the standards of conduct and the requirements for licensure, and they would then make an investigation and determination as to whether an individual would be issued a license or disciplinary action would be taken, or if there would be other remedies that would be necessary given the offense or given the filing of the complaint.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Moonen, is that who moved the bill? Powell, Representative Powell. He's not here, but he renews his motion, I'm sure.
to move House File 593 to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
The next bill before us is House File 1244. Representative Petersburg. Welcome to the committee, Representative Petersburg. Representative O'Neill moves House File 1244 that it be re-referred to the Transportation Finance Committee. To your bill, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for hearing this bill. This bill is a fairly straightforward bill, and it revolves around driveway access or access to property. In a transportation issue. The state is required to provide access to people's property from a driveway or some other version of access. And the current process is sets up where generally it's the district engineer that makes decision on where that access occurs. And sometimes there's a great discretion given for that particular decision, and people who are aggrieved or feel that may be a wrong decision have really no process to really get to an appeal process. And so this, other than going back to the original person that made the original decision, basically what this bill does is it sends it to an administrative law judge if they want to pursue that. Administrative law judge makes the determination, sends that off to the Commissioner of Transportation, and the commissioner then makes the final decision. And the administrative law judge is required also to keep copies and records of the documents and the data that is collected during the review. And that's it in a nutshell. And I do have Mr. Coyle here to answer questions if you like, or we can go on with other questions as well.
Very fine. Any member questions? Representative Lesh?
So we had I don't know how many years we've been talking about this. I can't remember. Yeah. But apparently you guys got everything worked out on it or something? The driveway stuff? Okay, good.
So nice. Representative Lunin?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yeah, this is in my district in Shakopee, this has been a real problem just south of town on 169. We've got industrial-sized trucks trying to enter the highway and not enter the highway. We've had probably an intolerable level of fatalities with cars running into them getting in. And I know there was a frustration with when they changed some of the roadways as far as the voice given to the businesses along there, because this is, I mean, the business exposure where there's a big discrepancy in what size vehicle or what speed vehicle, should I say, using that, that's where this becomes so important. And this has been chronic in my district for 10 years, so it's kind of nice to see that it's resolved, and hopefully we can apply that to what we've got going on down in the our area, actually all the way down the 169 corridor down to Mankato, because it has such an effect on the flow of traffic when you've got the mixed usage.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and you are absolutely correct. And we don't want the department to have, we want the department to err on the side of safety and making decisions that are appropriate from what they have. But because there is a lot of discretion in how that occurs, this particular bill just gives a third party an opportunity to look at it to make sure that we are doing the best interests of all parties concerned. And so I appreciate your discussion.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is MnDOT okay with this, too? I mean, they're feeling that it's a good process to go through?
Representative Petersburg?
Yes. The original bill from a year or two ago actually took it into district court. They thought that was a little bit too onerous, and they now are certainly agreeable to having it go in front of an administrative law judge, which is a lot less work for them and is more valuable as well. So.
Any other member questions? Is there anyone in the audience wishing to talk? Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question. I know this, you have in here that this pertains to driveways, but there's other issues where you have basically a frontage road, and again, down in that same problem area I'm talking about, where snow is going to get put and who's responsible for it. This mechanism, can that be an applied solution to that problem as well?
Representative Petersburg.
It could be. It's not specific, and I know that there is some bills now trying to deal with some of the frontage road issues that are out there, but this one didn't address that specifically. But certainly the department could and others could use that process if that's available at the time. But this bill does not address that issue.
Yeah, thank you.
Very good. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify for or against the bill? Seeing no one, Representative O'Neill renews her motion that House File 1244 be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. You're on your way. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Smith. Representative Smith, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1538 before this committee.
Very fine. And do you have an amendment?
I do, Madam Chair, members. The A17 amendment is something I'd like to have added to the bill to get the bill in the shape that I would like.
Thank you. Is there a discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A17, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. And did you have an oral amendment?
Madam Chair, I did, yes. Madam Chair, members, on line 4.2, the sixth word I would like added after the fifth word, I'd like the word private added, just the single word private. So 4.2 would read, subcontractor, developer, declarant, engineer, or private inspector performing or furnishing the.
Thank you. Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Smith did speak with me about this. I heard yesterday from, I think it was the firefighters who had an issue with the broad applicability of this, and I have no objection to the oral amendment.
Thank you, Representative Lesh, for putting that on the record. Appreciate that. Representative Smith, to your bill. We need to adopt that oral amendment. All those in favor of the oral amendment as stated by Representative Smith, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. The oral amendment is adopted. Now to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill has been an odyssey. It has been a long process. There's been many, many meetings with stakeholders from all areas. And it's been a reflection. There's been a lot of discussion, a lot of thoughtful consideration to address the home ownership issues in our state. And I want to thank Senator Desick for her authorship in the Senate. I would like to thank the co-authors on this bill in this body for this bipartisan bill, especially Mayor Dean for his co-authorship as well. And Madam Chair, we have a series of testifiers. I would like to start, and if we could start with the three mayors that are with us today.
Sure. I have Mayor Gene Winstead, Jim Hovland, and Denny Loffenberger. Welcome to the committee, gentlemen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll have you just each, as you give your personal testimony, just each, before you give it, please just introduce yourselves for the tape.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Denny Loffenberger, the mayor of Chanhassen. Chanhassen is a community of 25,000 people in eastern Carver County, the southwest metro area, and we are a growing community. We have several large parcels that are due for development over the next 5 to 10 years, and I'm speaking in support of House File 1538. I agree that a full range of housing choices is critical for competitiveness in our region, and that home ownership is a key component of healthy communities like Chanhassen. Over the past decade, the production of condominiums, townhomes, and cooperatives has declined dramatically in our community. 10 years ago, 104 townhomes and condos were built in Chanhassen. In 2015, 4 condos and townhomes were built in Chanhassen. I fully support the bipartisan legislative efforts to support the development of condominiums, townhomes, and cooperatives by reducing the risk of unwarranted litigation. And I believe that legislation must include the elements that are currently in the bill, House File 1538. I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Jim Hublin, and the mayor of Edina. I will tell you that anecdotally, about 3 months ago, I was asked to speak with the Edina realtors. Many of them gathered, dozens and dozens of them, started into my presentation about all the new housing we were adding on a rental basis. And, of course, our town has been very active on a single-family home basis. Unlike Chanhassen, we were fully developed. But when we looked at the records, we noticed that we hadn't had any townhouse or condominium development for over 10 years. And so when I spoke with the Edina realtors, the hands started shooting up into the air, and they were asking, where are the condominiums? Where are the condominiums? We need more condominium product, and we need more townhouse product. Every day we have customers in Edina that want to move from their single-family homes into owner-occupied multifamily residence or into townhomes. We just don't have the product. Well, we started investigating both locally and then as the regional council of mayors and looking at this issue on a broad basis and determined that there were some things about the existing law that were causing potential and actual condo developers not to be doing that kind of work anymore. Same thing with townhouse developers. So we're all about making sure that homeowners have the sorts of warranty protections that they need to have. And I think that that's one of the things about this bill that's important, is that it maintains those sort of warranty protections. But there are some other things, I think, that are very beneficial. In the construction industry, for example, the idea that you'd mediate a settlement before you would actually start litigation is important. Also, I think it's important is the fact that the whole association would be voting, and a majority of the people in the association, not just the board itself, would be making a determination as to whether or not they want to pursue a defect claim. Also, with respect to attorney's fees, it's not uncommon for folks to pay their own attorney's fees with respect to a dispute, and I think the mediation offers a good way to curtail some of those legal fees that could occur. So when we looked at it on balance, we thought that this was a good approach by the architects, the development community, the construction community, and how to make sure that we're getting a wide range of product in our communities for housing choices without jeopardizing the rights of our existing homeowners or homeowners that might want to move into owner-occupied housing to protect their rights to discover defects over a reasonable period of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir, if you want to introduce yourself for the tape, that'd be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gene Winstead, Mayor of the City of Bloomington. And I'm here today also to speak in support of House File 1538. And not dissimilar to Chanhassen or Edina, Bloomington is one that needs to seek that balance of housing choices within its community. Edina indicated that they haven't had any development of condominium or townhouse for a few years. There has been absolutely no development of townhouse or condominium since 2005 in the city of Bloomington. While at the same time we've seen development of commercial space, we've filled out many of our subdivisions, any property that's had infill, single-family residential has taken place, and we've had the building of many apartment buildings throughout there. But there's been absolutely no development of condominiums. And as Mayor Hovland indicated, many of the reasons why are stated throughout the bill, and this bill could rectify those situations. To speak anecdotally, the City of Bloomington, passed a resolution in support of 1538, which will be provided. But in that discussion at our City Council level, one of my City Council members is a condominium owner. He lives in a townhouse complex. He's there, and he indicated and brought with him a letter that he had received from a realtor begging him to sell his townhouse because they have such a demand for people wanting this type of housing, people who have lived in the city of Bloomington, who wanted to stay in the city of Bloomington, who are looking to either downsize or take on this form of housing. Now, you might say that that letter just represents creative marketing, but I call it desperation marketing because there is such a demand out there for it. We see things, too, within the city of Bloomington. One of the provisions in this bill is for the associations to set up a maintenance program going forward. What we've seen in the city of Bloomington, when we had the development of townhomes and condominiums back probably in the 80s is when we saw a peak of this kind of development, was now we're looking at it, and these different townhome associations have had a problem keeping up with the maintenance on their within their properties. So we have actually set up a fund within the city that the associations then could take and get lending in order to do it, because they've had a hard time doing it on their own because of the multi-ownership fashion of an association. So with that said, we've seen the need for this in there, and so that provision of this bill, I think, speaks wonders to something that could really benefit all into the future. So we are here. We think that the provisions of this bill do still and can create and preserve the rights, the warranty rights of the owners, and we would like to see it so we could get going with some development or housing we see in demand in our city.
Thank you. And members, what we're going to do is we're going to hear from all the testifiers. We have a long list, so we're going to hear from all the testifiers, and then we'll take member questions. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here and for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, I have Carl Runk with Ryan Companies and Brad Richardson with Schaefer Richardson. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Good morning. It's actually Brad Schaefer with Schaefer Richardson, but my partner, Mr. Richardson, who's in California enjoying his retirement, I'm sure appreciates the notoriety this morning.
All right. Thank you.
I'm here really to talk about sort of what it's really felt. I'm a real estate investor, builder, developer, manager. We've done thousands of transactions over the years. We've developed almost 2,000 units of housing over the last 15 years. We haven't developed a condominium since 2006. Part of that's due to the economy, and that's why we stopped. But the reason why we haven't restarted is why we're here today. And I've got some, you know, I'll just tell one quick story. We did a project in 2004-05. We built it with Krauss Anderson as our builder, very reputable builder in town. We got a phone call shortly after we completed it. We had a couple of windows that were leaking. Okay, they're caulked by hand, by individuals. That can happen. We sent a crew out there. Krauss Anderson sent a crew out there. We said, okay, we'll take care of it. We should do an investigation about what other windows might be leaking, if there are any other windows that are leaking. We didn't hear anything for a couple of days. The next thing we know, we had a lawsuit sitting on our desk. What this is really about is the current regulation, they're incented to take that they will not take yes for an answer. It is much more expedient for them and profitable for them to litigate, as opposed to let's just figure out what the problem is and fix it. Again, we tried to get in there. They actually barred us from the property and brought in consultants who then determined we had to spend, that it, all the windows had to be replaced, over 400 of them. Made no sense. Then they determined that the stucco, which was brand new, needed to be replaced. Of course, several years go by. There's a lawsuit, lots of attorneys, lots of insurance companies. We don't even know. Everyone was a confidential settlement. We don't know what we know what we had to pay. We don't know what anyone else had to pay. We don't know what the condominium association received. But we do know that they did not replace the windows and they did not replace the stucco because, in fact, there was nothing wrong with it. I think it was just a build up a case for a very significant lawsuit. Again, the real issue is they would not take yes for an answer. We wanted to help. We were actively trying to help, and they cut off communication. A few days passed, and a lawsuit arrived on our desk unannounced. And that's the problem with the current statute.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Carl Runk with Ryan Companies. We're the largest real estate developer and second largest general contractor in the state. My job as a real estate developer is to run a process of dreaming up and delivering buildings that satisfy market demands. Many of those buildings include multifamily residential apartments. Since the economic recovery, Ryan Companies has developed and built over 1,700 rental apartments and zero for-sale condominiums or townhomes. Several of these apartment locations, including new walk-up row home-style rental units facing the new Commons Park by U.S. Bank Stadium, were strongly considered early on to be for-sale condos, but we decided the risks weren't worth it. So why aren't we developing for-sale condominiums? It's not because there's a lack of demand. Demand is higher than now than it was at the peak of the pre-recession condo boom. We're continuing to develop rentals over condos largely because litigation has exploded in the last decade. There was a time when few of these disputes turned into lawsuits. Now there are nearly always lawsuits filed or threatened constantly, in many cases with claims arising 6 to 9 years after we completed the project, each being expensive and time-consuming to settle. With litigation exploding, we've also seen condo construction insurance costs skyrocket and many insurance carriers no longer wanting to touch condos with a 10-foot pole. Condo insurance carriers are sick and tired of lawsuits. Architects are gun-shy about designing condo projects due to all the lawsuits. The few remaining insurance carriers who will do condos are charging extraordinary premiums because they have factored lawsuits into those costs. Unless this law changes, the only condominium developments that we, Ryan Companies, as a developer, will pursue are smaller buildings priced at the very upper bracket with average home prices in many cases approaching $1 million and higher that can absorb the additional costs, liabilities, and hassle we're taking on compared to just developing more rental apartment buildings. The risk-reward balance to develop condos simply doesn't make sense in the vast majority of Minnesota neighborhoods and cities that we're in. Minnesota's history as a national leader in home ownership rates, including both single-family and multifamily for sale options at a variety of price points, are in jeopardy unless this law changes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Ryan Hamilton. And then after him, Gene Sullivan and Patrick Hines. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ryan Hamilton, and I'm with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. The mayor's there kind of stole my thunder with all the realtor stories, but I do meet with realtors also, and whenever I do meet with them, I ask, hey, it's normally in a formal setting, but at the end of it, I always ask, how's the market doing? And the response I've gotten is, oh, we're doing real well, multiple offers, bidding wars, but there's a lack of inventory. And at the end of our last Government Affairs Committee, right before this session, I asked the same question, how's the market doing? Same answer, multiple offers, you're doing well, but lack of inventory. It's like, wait a minute, guys, I've been with you guys, what, 4 or 5 years, and you keep saying lack of inventory. What does that mean? And one of the members chimed in and says, well, I asked, are people still underwater? Is that why they're not selling their homes? And they said, no. They have nowhere to go. I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, we could probably sell our homes and do pretty well, but it's incredibly difficult to find that next suitable property or home because there's just not enough inventory out there. So in that balance, people say, hey, I'm just going to stay put, so therefore not put their home on the market. I tell that story to illustrate some data that I've included in your packets dealing with home inventory, and this is what it looks like. That first page with 14 on the bottom right, it just shows the overall volume, and as you see the tail on that chart, it's going down. On the next page, 15 on the bottom right, it's the month supply of inventory. And as you notice, a healthy market is between 4.5 to 5 months. And right now, the trend is down, and we're looking at, in 2016, we're looking at 2.4 months supply of inventory. That's well below a healthy market. The next page shows the average sales price. If you'll notice, between 15, 16, and 17, that's going up. So that's why when I ask my realtor friends, hey, how's the market? Yeah, prices are going up because there's competition over a limited stock. And that final page is the Housing Affordability Index. And that's the median home price in comparison to the median household income. And as you notice in Minnesota, this is statewide data, our affordability is going down. This data encompasses all of our housing stock, not just condos and townhomes. But condos and townhomes are a key piece of that inventory puzzle. And if we think about it anecdotally, think about who's out there looking for homes. It's baby boomers or empty nesters who want to downsize and the millennials who are trying to enter the market. Well, what's the perfect product for those two massive demographics, townhomes and condos? So in light of this demand, as we've heard from the mayors and previous testifiers, why aren't these things being built? And that's why we're here before you today. So, and just one more note. As realtors, we represent aspiring homeowners and the current homeowners. So the consumer protection aspect of this, of the current, that's not lost on us. Anytime we come before you with asking for a solution to these type of problems, we're asking for balance. And we believe Rep. Smith's bill provides that balance and a reasonable solution to the inventory problem, and at least in regards to condos and townhomes. Thank you.
Thank you. Gene Sullivan and Patrick Hines. Good morning. Please state your name for the record and go with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines. I represent the Community Associations Institute of Minnesota, or CAI. CAI's members include homeowners in condominium associations, property managers, and other business partners who work with condo associations. While CAI does not support this legislation, I would like to thank Representative Smith for his willingness to take their concerns very seriously and to sit down with us and discuss those concerns. I'll note that the A-17 amendment that the committee adopted at the beginning was in response to concerns that we raised with the scope of the bill, and we certainly appreciate that amendment being adopted. There are really many factors in the market which are going to determine what types of housing are being built. Obviously, there is demand, there's interest rates, there is construction and labor costs, and risk on the developers is one of those issues. But it's only one of those issues, and the bill really only tackles that. It doesn't make any attempt to address perhaps the underlying construction defects that are the subject of many of these claims. I think there could be frivolous lawsuits in this area like there can be in life, but I'm familiar with many condominium associations in my past private practice where there were significant construction defects that resulted in millions of dollars of damage, and the homeowners are trying to protect their investments. So we don't think the bill on the whole balances the homeowner protections with the developer desire to have less risk and liability. There's some other people who will testify on some specific issues. I wanted to go through a couple of the specific provisions in the bill, if I may, to raise our concerns. On page 9, line 9.30 to 9. I apologize. I was looking at the I had the wrong page marked. Lines 18.27 to 18.29. We have a lot of concern with this provision. It's a blanket provision that says a development party should not have liability under this section for loss or damage caused by the failure of the association or unit owner to comply with the new obligations in the bill, which mainly have to do with preventative maintenance. I think there are a couple key issues to keep in mind that often get overlooked. When a developer creates a condominium, the developer appoints the first board of directors and controls the association up until the time of turnover, which occurs when a majority of the units have been sold. So it's the developer that's in control of the association during the construction period. It's the developer that's in control when these type of preventative maintenance plans should be put together. And perhaps most importantly, it's the developer who sets those initial assessments and dues that are required to be paid by the homeowners. And it's those dues that would fund any maintenance. Developers obviously have an incentive to keep those dues as low as is reasonably possible, because when you're a homeowner and you're going to buy a condo, like any other homeowner, you're going to have a certain amount of a mortgage payment that you can make. But when you buy a condo, you also have to include the monthly dues you're going to pay. And if the dues are too high, you may end up having a condo that you no longer feel you can afford. So there's pressure on developers to keep those dues down, even though there's pressure in this bill on creating preventative maintenance to keep those up. This language here doesn't make a distinction between an association that's been appointed by the developer and an association of the homeowners that happens after turnover. So you have a situation where the developer can be off the hook for actions that his or her appointed association took, and we have serious concerns with that language. I won't get into the attorney fee provision because I know that there are others who will talk about that specifically. I would like to note the effective date. It would apply to construction claims commenced on or after the effective date. This means that existing condominiums who have been playing under a set of rules for a number of years will have those rules changed. if the point of the bill is looking forward and reducing liability and risk going forward, we think that the effective date should only apply to condominiums created on or after August 1st, 2017. And that term creation is a term of art in Chapter 515B. It happens when the declaration is recorded in the county, so there'd be a very clear date when that condominium is created. We think that is more fair to the existing condo owners, and we think it makes more sense if the purpose of this bill is a forward-looking reduction of liability and risk for developers. And I'll let the other testifiers speak to some of the other points of the bill. I'm certainly happy to stand for any questions members have. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Gene Sullivan, and I'm President and CEO of New Concepts Management. We are a property management firm whose core business has been the management of homeowner associations for over 30 years now. And I wish to speak against House File 1538. There are several concerns that I have representing our clients. It has been in my experience that when a homeowner association has been transferred from the developer or builder into the hands of the homeowners, it is not uncommon at all to see those first budgets that are set up for the operations of the property as well as the long-term capital replacement items in the reserves to be lower than what they should be. One of our first jobs as a management company over and over again is to redo the capital replacement reserves because it is not an adequate statement of what is really what the association needs to be responsible for. And as Patrick has already mentioned, there's several motivators that a builder or developer has for keeping those low. And the one that he mentioned already was it makes it more enticing for someone to purchase something, and they have an unrealistic version of what the costs are to maintain. The other aspect is that, you know, the developer or builder owns 100% of the association to begin with. And then if they have 100 units, they own 99% when the first one is sold. And when the first one is sold and that person now is starting to pay monthly assessments, now the builder has to pay assessments on all the ones that they have. And so they have a motivation to want to keep things low. And part of what I see as a detriment with this bill now is that what we're saying to a homeowner in an association is that the builder or developer who wasn't realistic in those first operation budgets set up, they didn't set up, if it was a big concern, all of these maintenance schedules that needed to be handed. But now they're saying, by the way, you need to, homeowner association, show and demonstrate that you've got this these schedules all in order. And by the way, if you don't, after a certain period of time, that absolves us from any obligation or liability. To me, that just seems unequal and a huge concern. Another provision that I have a great concern with in the way the bill is written too is in the idea or notion that a homeowner association must first receive a majority of all of the homeowners who must sign off and agree before litigation takes place. A couple of things that I would point out: a homeowners association is nothing more than a privately held corporation. Would you want to put that kind of prohibition on other privately held corporations to say, by the way, shareholders, a majority of all the shareholders have always got to agree before you can do any kind of lawsuit? That, to me, just seems a silly requirement, and it is not about the consumer protectionism, but I think it's more about putting a obstacle or a hurdle in the way that will prevent a homeowners association from being able to act. And so those are just a couple of concerns that I see in the current bill.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Please stick around if there are questions. It looks like we may be coming back this evening. So we have a few testifiers left and then a member discussion. So Gene Ranieri, and on deck would be Peter Coyle. Good morning. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the City of Minneapolis. The City of Minneapolis is experiencing incredible growth, just like many other cities in the region. When you look at the buildings, you are impressed. You see residential buildings all over our city, but particularly in the downtown area. But when you look at the numbers, and I profess I'm a geek, I like to look at data, and when you look at property tax data, most all of these units are rental occupied. They're not owner-occupied. And that's a concern for the city, concern for the region. We would like to see more owner-occupied multifamily buildings in the city. So back in 2014, our city council, IGR committee, asked us to do some research on what was causing the issue. We asked the question, we formed some questions like, is there a market demand for these types of units? Are there any other problems, like, for example, are there warranty issues? Are there financing issues? But then what we did, we asked the Builders Association of the Twin Cities to come and talk to our committee. They raised many of the issues that you see in this bill today by Representative Smith, and the city has been involved in this process. We worked closely early on in this long odyssey, and at this point we do support changes to make it possible for more affordable and more owner-occupied multifamily housing, townhouses, and condos to be built in the state and in the region and in our own city. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll stop and try and answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ranieri. Please stick around in case there are questions later. Peter Coyle, and then I have the American Institute of Architects. So if they have a representative here. Oh, you're coming together. Perfect. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Peter Coyle on behalf of the Builders Association of the Twin Cities. And I'm joined by a representative of Lennar, Madam Chair, who I think his name is listed, Mr. Bickle. So he'll testify jointly with me. I apologize if it doesn't show up on the testifier list. This bill squarely addresses two key issues that are of concern to the Builders Association of the Twin Cities: the high cost of housing, the growing cost of housing, and the lack of affordable housing in the market today. You've heard many people testify to that fact. I won't be redundant about it. Cost of housing that associates with the risks associated with multifamily ownership housing is a significant barrier to building it. We appreciate the efforts by Representative Smith to advance this bill. We think it will be a positive step forward for the industry, and we urge the committee's adoption of it at the conclusion of the testifiers today. With that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Good morning. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. If you want to get the mic kind of pointed towards you, that'd be great. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Morgan Bickle. I'm the Director of Construction Operations for Lennar, Minnesota. We're the largest home builder in the state. And I've been doing this a lot of years. And in 2007, the majority of the homes we built were condos and townhomes. Today, condos and townhomes represent less than 10% of the homes that we deliver. And as you've heard this morning, multifamily development is facing challenges. The prospect of homeowner association lawsuits related to warranty claims is one of the main factors that impacts our ability to purchase, develop, and build homes in condos and townhomes. It adds costs to our overall pro forma, is what we call it when we're looking at a land asset, trying to consider whether we should move forward or not. The cost for professional services or litigation is absolutely factored in, and it prevents us from moving forward on several opportunities to develop land for townhomes and and condo associated communities. As a home builder, we support House File 1538 because it places the focus for resolving construction or home performance issues between the homeowner and the home builder first. Too often we see HOAs rush to a lawsuit. In fact, there's many cases where we do not even hear about the reported defects until it's reported in the lawsuit. I want to thank Representative Smith for his leadership. I want to thank Madam Chair and members for the opportunity to speak this morning.
Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lake and Scott Andreessen. Good morning. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Lake. I have a solo practice law firm and representing the State Bar Association. Over the years, the real property section of the bar has done a lot of work on Chapter 515B, which this bill affects. And our aim has always been to try to maintain an appropriate balance of interest between developers, associations, and unit owners. There are some policy changes in this bill that we are not taking a position on, but our interest was mainly in making sure that it remains workable and operational from a technical perspective. And I think after a variety of meetings with the stakeholders, we've been able to achieve that goal. And I do want to thank the proponents, especially Representative Smith and some of the other proponents we work with, including Mr. Andreessen here, for their efforts to work with us and making sure that the bill is technically workable and fair to all parties.
Thank you, Mr. Lake. Please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Scott Andreessen. I'm a construction lawyer. I'm a construction litigator. And I'm here because I represent parties in all aspects of the construction industry. I've represented HOAs. I've represented individual owners, contractors, developers, subcontractors, material suppliers in litigation hundreds and hundreds of times relating to construction defects. And so sometimes I get asked by the industry at large to come in and give some thoughts on some of these issues. And in this particular case, the issue that was brought to my attention and others was what you've heard about from the mayors and then the developers and the contractors, which is no one wants to build condos and townhouses. And one of the reasons that they cite is all of the lawsuits that have occurred over the past decade or so. And so myself and others were asked, what are the drivers? What are the drivers of those lawsuits over these years that are causing the developers and the contractors to not want to build? And so we looked at it, and we talked to the community, we talked to the real estate community, and we thought about our own experience as the people who litigate these cases. And a lot of what we did is we looked at it and said, what's the distinction between a condominium and a townhouse and all the other housing stock? Builders and developers right now do not see the risk associated with building a single-family home isn't stopping them from building single-family homes, as you can see in the numbers from the realtors. The risk associated with building apartment buildings isn't stopping them from building apartment buildings, as you can see in the information from the realtors. The risk is part of what's stopping them from building condos and townhouses. And so what are the differences in the risks associated with condos and townhouses and apartments and single-family homes? And the first place you have to go is to go to 515B, because that statute does not apply to single-family homes. It does not apply to apartment buildings. It only applies to townhouses, condominiums, and cooperatives. So we looked at what's different. What are the differences that could be driving this difference in litigation and risk profile? And there are several, and what we did is we set out to say, could we affect enough change in 515B to change the risk profile so all of these folks in the development community will build the things that the mayors over here want? And in doing that, we looked at 327A, which is the statutory warranty, the consumer protection statute that applies to single-family homes and apartments, and compared it to 515B, and there are some stark differences. And obviously there's differences beyond just the two statutes. There's differences in the model, right, the association community ownership model. So we had to take that into account as well. But in doing that, there were several things that we looked at. And I'll start with one that was addressed by one of the folks who came up and testified earlier, and that related to maintenance. Interesting, we all of us who live in a single-family home, it's my responsibility to do the maintenance on my home, right? And Chapter 327A protects me if I build a new home, right? That builder has to give me certain warranties under that law. That law has a very specific provision in it that says that these warranties do not protect you, homeowner, if you don't maintain your home. There was no such provision in 515B. That's just one example of what we were doing when we went through the process. And so I give that now just as an example of how we approach this and trying to address the mayor's concerns and the development community concerns. And so we looked at it and said, well, wouldn't it make sense? Why is there any less responsibility to maintain a condo or a townhouse than there is a single-family home or an apartment? I would suggest to you there's a greater responsibility because there are common elements, right? I'm responsible for the exterior of my house. If you live, Madam Chair, in a condominium, you're not responsible for the maintenance and the caulking on the exterior of that building. Someone has to do it because you're not going to think to do it because you have common areas. Well, no one was thinking to do it in a lot of cases, and the law didn't require them to do it, and the law didn't have any consequences for failure to do it like it did in 327A. That's one of the elements we put in the bill. And the language that was cited to you as potentially problematic about there's no liability if you fail to, under 515B, if you fail to maintain, was taken word for word from 327A for this very reason, right? It seems to apply equally to all types of housing, and we made sure to do that. And so we put an obligation in this provision because one of the things that the developers told us and the contractors is we keep going back to these buildings 4, 5, 6, 7 years down the road, and they tell us they've got a leaky window and we want to address it, and what we look at is no one's maintained the caulk in 7 years. No one's maintained this or no one's maintained that. It's because there was no obligation to maintain it. There's no requirement to have a maintenance plan. So in talking to the development community, the suggestion was made, and I thought it was a good one, put in a requirement that you have a maintenance plan. And in fact, going back to requiring it in the future for future common interest communities, we put a provision in here that says it has to be in the budget that's created by the declarant initially so that there is no surprise down the road that you need to do this. You need to create a maintenance plan, and you need to put it in your budget. And as far as the fact that, and I'll address this, I think, to a broader extent more, the effective date, we were very careful in trying to not lay traps for the unwary. So while many provisions of this bill do apply to existing common interest communities, this one, for instance, if you say you have to have a maintenance provision and there's consequences if you don't, we didn't think it would be fair to just have that be effective August 1st if this were to pass, right? So there's a window that I believe is actually about 18 months that actually says that existing common interest communities have a longer period of time in order to comply with this law so that they have the opportunity from their property managers to get this information to say, hey, we got to go out, we got to get a maintenance plan in place, and we got to follow it. That's the process that we followed. The same thing, and I'll address one of the other elements of the bill that was addressed by one of the testifiers, which is this notion of majority consent. One other very unique difference between a 515B scenario and our single-family homes or an apartment, which typically has a single owner and tenants, is in 515B, the way it's set up now, the board of directors controls the operation of the condominium association. That's normal. That you have to have that. You could have 200 unit condominiums, right? And you may have 3 people or 5 people who are on a board. But the law as it is right now gives a majority of those 3 or 5 people the ability to sue on behalf of all of the people who live in that community. And they don't need their consent. They don't even need to give them any information about why they're doing it, right? That, in this particular scenario, and as somebody who's litigated these cases, is one of the biggest concerns that we've had. Because what we have is we have a situation where you could have a 100-unit condominium building here and a 100-unit apartment building here. And over here, with the condominiums, 2 out of 3 people could decide to sue on behalf of all 100. In your single-family home, okay, if you want to take on the cost, right, and the expense and the time of a lawsuit, you have to decide to do it. It affects your rights. You would then later have to sign a release if you settled the case. That doesn't apply in 515B currently. Right now, when those majority of the board can sue on behalf of someone else who lives there, and they don't have to tell them that they're suing, and they don't have to tell them why, and they don't have to get their permission, they sue not only on behalf of the association, but on behalf of those people. The notion that, two people should be able to start a lawsuit on behalf of others, what if they don't have a problem with their unit? And one thing that happens, and it happens frequently in these cases, as I talk to the homeowners who are plaintiffs, and one just anecdote where I talk to one scenario where there's 120 unit owners. I talked to all 120. 80 of them had no idea that the lawsuit had been filed, right, at the time we were about to take their deposition. And many, many of them were unhappy about it for the one reason, I won't get into the others. They wanted to sell. They wanted to sell their condominium, and they come to find out, because the association has to do a disclosure when they do that, that they can't because they'd have to disclose the lawsuit. No one asked them if they wanted to sue. No one told them they were going to sue. And now they can't sell their unit because their board got them in a lawsuit. What we sought to do with this particular provision, and there's two pieces of the legislation that relate to this, is to say that a board, before it can sue, has to provide information to all of the owners about what's going on. What are the construction defects? If you have engineering reports, give them to them. Tell them what the issues are, number one. And then number two, you have to go and get a majority of those owners to consent to sue on behalf of the association. But all of them at least have the opportunity to weigh in. They all know it's happening. It's never a surprise. And if a majority of them consent to that lawsuit, the association still has the ability to sue. That's another big driver in this particular scenario. The last piece that is different between 327A, single-family home and apartment warranties, and 515B, is there's an attorney fee provision in 515B that is not in 327A. There is no right under your warranties as a new homeowner in a single-family home or an apartment owner to recover your attorney's fees if you sue. There is in 515B. It's a prevailing party provision. So it isn't just that the homeowners could recover or the unit owners could recover their attorney's fees. It's technically the developer or the could recover their attorney's fees. But prevailing party means you have to go to trial and you have to win. Well, having been involved in this, I can tell you that 99 out of every 100 of these cases settle. They don't go to trial. No one wins. And that's true just from a big picture common sense standpoint. No one wins. And so in this scenario, it's one of the other big differences that we said, and the development community and the contractor community said, look, this is an incentive for people to sue us. And Mr. Schaefer talked about it earlier in a particular case where they were investigating something and a lawsuit came. That doesn't happen if everybody has to be thoughtful about what they're doing. They have to consent. They have to give information, and everybody knows they're paying their own attorney's fees. The last thing I'll say, and I appreciate your patience with me, is that we didn't change one word in the warranties that are given to the unit owners or the associations. The warranties, the implied warranties and the express warranties, which are the basis of their claims and their lawsuits, we didn't touch a word. So what this lawsuit does, what this bill does not do, is it doesn't prevent HOAs from suing. It just simply says you got to go give information to your members, get their consent of a majority of them, and then let's go try to mediate first. And if you can't get the case settled at mediation, then you have all the rights that you had previously to sue under all the same warranty protection.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Members, we are going to recess. Most likely we will come back about 15 minutes after the end of session. And we have a list of people that have questions. We have to open up the testimony to anyone in the audience wishing to testify. I haven't done that yet. And so, members, watch your emails as far as the location, as far as where we'll meet. So with that, we're in recess. I'll bring this back tonight.
Okay.
We will reconvene the Civil Law Data Practices Committee. Thank you for your indulgence. And I know it's been kind of a scurry to get people, testifiers and stuff, back this direction to the state office building. So I wanted to give people a little bit of time to arrive. What we're going to do is just pick up with testimony on the Smith bill, House File 1538. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Terrific. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Irene Gow and I'm from the League of Minnesota Cities. We don't officially have a position on this bill, but there was an issue and concern that was raised, which was addressed by the author's oral amendment earlier this morning that had inserted the word private before inspectors. Cities did have a concern that that could be read to include building official as well as fire inspectors, and with the with private in front of inspectors, that will no longer be read that way.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to testify? Mr. Carlson's making his way down.
I walked up the hill from downtown to get here, Madam Chair.
Oh, man. What's the weather like?
It's a little brisk.
Is it? Well, thank you for hustling back.
Thank you.
That's good, Madam Chair.
We actually have Madam Chair and members, Joel Carlson for the Association for Justice, and we actually have a member who's on his way to talk about the bill in greater detail. So, I wasn't going to speak on this bill, Madam Chair, and I know I have the right to remain silent. Sometimes I lack the ability. But we do have concerns about the bill, and I'll just point out a couple of them as we go along. And one of them just starts off right away on page 3. And if you look at page 3, the new definition of a construction defect claim now includes a personal injury caused by the defect. And if you follow the construct of the bill, if I'm injured by the construction defect, I now have to get authority from my condo association to bring a personal injury claim. I would have to mediate it. If I get the approval to go forward with a personal injury claim, the roof collapses on me, on my unit, and I'm injured. This bill now, because that is now defined as a construction defect claim, I have to go through all this procedure to even bring that claim. I don't know that that's intended, but that's really how the bill is written, and I would have serious reservations about that. We do have concerns, and you'll hear more about it, about the problem that that owners have in bringing these types of claims. All of these claims that you're going to hear about are based on building code violations. These are structures that were built outside of code. So Representative Howe, we're not talking about I don't like the color of the shingles. We're talking about defects that are the result of building code violations. That's what these claims are based on. These aren't people that are inventing problems. These are people who have tried to resolve things, have tried to get things fixed. They have resulted or resorted to litigation to bring accountability back to the system. What the law has said and has long said is that if you bring that claim and you prevail and they have to fix your property, we're going to make you whole. And the way we make you whole is by paying your litigation costs and expenses and your reasonable attorney fees, because we don't want that kind of conduct. This takes that away in a pretty serious way. And I'm not in love with the fee-shifting provision in this particular statute. I wouldn't argue for it, because if the homeowner association is wrong, they have to pay the other side's fee, too. That's not usually how these fee-shifting things work, but that's how it works here, and that's what makes it fair. That's what prevents the homeowner association from bringing forward a claim that doesn't have merit, because they know if they do that, and they proceed with that case, they're going to be held accountable for the other side's fees and costs. That's not normally how we do these, but that's how it is here. We're taking that away, and I really think that's an important protection that we should think about taking away for homeowners. With this, as everyone knows, it is your, in many instances, it's your most valuable asset, and you happen to own it with other people in a common interest, but it's probably your most valuable asset, and we really want to be able to protect those people. And, you know, as to the issue about this being an impediment to, you know, to condo construction, I'm sensitive to that because we do want to have home ownership. But just as recently as May of 2016, there was an article in MinPost that said the condo market's coming back in Minneapolis. It is happening. How do we fix the problems that are out there without taking away the important rights that we have? I thought the suggestion that Attorney Andreessen had this morning relative to having a maintenance plan is a good one. I think that's a step in the right direction. What are these problems that are related to maintenance versus construction defects? I think that's a constructive change that's in the bill, and it's something that I think we should try and get our arms around and support. But simply taking away the tools that homeowners have to have their cases heard in court, we think goes a little bit too far. So, Madam Chair, just as we're waiting for Will Rogers, who's our witness, to come and testify, just again point out the problem with including personal injury in the definition of a construction defect claim and where that is noted. It's in a couple places in the bill because it goes on when you look at the mitigation section, and again, I apologize for having to run up here, but on page 19, as you look at the condition precedent to filing a construction claim, you have to submit this to mediation, mutually agreeable. All of that would apply to an injury that happens because of a construction defect, and we just think that that is just unfair and probably unconstitutional. And lastly, on the effective date, and we do argue about these frequently around here, I agree with the comments that Patrick Hines put before you. This should be for construction that is commenced on or after the effective date. You know, this now would have a reach back for your claim that is commenced after the effective date. It could reach back 10 years. And that's a problem because we are changing the rules of the game. And sometimes the legislature does that deliberately. And that effective date that's in there has been well litigated by the courts. And what that means is that it reaches back as far as the statute of limitation goes. And the cases called them Goldman versus Northland Physicians, where they said this effective date is the legislature's intent to make it retroactive. So you are now saying that all of those condos that have been built and insured prior to the effective date of this act now have this new set of rules, and I think that's unfair. Madam Chair and members, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience that is wishing to testify at this point? What we'll do then, members, we'll go ahead and start taking member questions, and if there are other testifiers that show up in the in-between, we'll just accommodate those folks. So I have seven people on the list, beginning with Representative Lesh. Is it for, I don't know if you have some of the testifiers have gone home now. But
well, yeah, Madam Chair, that was one of the things I wanted to bring up. You know, this little Texas two-step that we just did with the adjourning and everything. First of all, you know, there are people that were there for floor vote on this preemption thing, yada, yada, yada. But then there's a bunch of people who I presume would have been back here for this. And some of my major questions were for proponents who are gone now. And we held off on those questions, Madam Chair. How soon? Because I'll hold off.
Okay.
I mean, are the mayors coming and Brad Schaefer coming and Carl Runk coming? Are they all coming?
Madam Chair?
Representative Smith.
Yes, the representative. One of the mayors is on his way. And other than that, I expect everyone else to be back, and they are en route. So they'll be here shortly.
Well,
Representative Lash.
Okay, are there any developers here now, or are they're still coming? All right.
You can say.
Well, who's the guy in the yellow tie? I forgot what you do again.
Andreessen? Mr. Andreessen?
I'm an attorney.
Oh. My question.
You want to hear from?
My question goes more toward the developer stuff. So I'll hold off on my questions for now until they get here, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right, sounds good. The next person on the list is Representative Pugh.
Let's see here. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, first of all, I wanted to acknowledge, and I'll do so for the record because I don't know if he'll be one of the mayors returning, but Mayor Denny Loffenberger was here, my mayor from Chanhassen. I wanted to thank him and all of the other mayors who were here this morning to testify. There was a document in our packet, which I don't have in front of me, speaking to the amount of inventory that I think each of us who met with anyone in advance of, you know, hearing this bill, have a recap of how much inventory each of our districts has on hand. And, you know, after having met with builders in my district the last week, realtors in my district, it became crystal clear that, you know, I'm very supportive of what Representative Smith has done with his bill, and became clear that we have a real problem. I think the testifier this morning, Mr. Schaefer, put an exclamation point on that point. I have zero inventory in my district right now, and it's a significant problem for affordable housing, for young families, and we have a growing community, a lot of land that is ready for development, and no inventory on hand, and no developers who are interested in pursuing this because of the litigious nature of this situation. So anyway, I think I'll just make that comment and thank Representative Smith for having brought his bill.
Thank you, Representative Pugh. Representative Lunan?
I'm going to pass, Madam Chairman.
All right. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't have any questions. It was just more of a comment from earlier after the testimony from, and I forget it, don't know his name, the attorney in the yellow tie.
Mr. Andreessen.
And I just, as both a real estate agent and a general contractor myself, I wanted to remark that I was very impressed with the testimony and the articulation of what developers do and builders do in terms of evaluating regulation and looking at risk and potential liability, and then having to make a decision. And so, as we're aware, government regulation needs a balance, and the free market is the best barometer indicating overregulation by government, and that's exactly what was quantified. So removing risk limit caps, preventing the ability to quantify potential financial liability into the future, results in businesses existing markets or skyrocketing prices, or both, businesses exiting markets, or prices to skyrocket, or both. And that's exactly what's happening. In this case, it's exiting markets. And so I appreciate the bill author, Representative Smith, and I appreciate that this is a bipartisan bill, because it's a recognition that the free market is responding to the lack of ability to quantify risk. And rather than take that risk, they just simply remove themselves from the market. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Carlson, I guess my question goes to, if you talked about the building code, that this is mainly a problem with code enforcement. So my question is, do you find most of these problems in building code areas, out of building code areas? Just exactly where is most of this effort, and is that a problem that we could fix in a different way?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Powell, thank you for the question, and I think Attorney Rogers will be able to answer that much better than I. But when you ask me the question, in building code or out, you mean jurisdictions that enforce the building? I'm wondering, I want to make sure I understand your question.
Representative Powell.
You know, that's a good point that most folks don't understand, Mr. Carlson, is that the building code applies statewide, it's just not enforced statewide.
Exactly.
And therein lies the problem, is you have residential contractors that have to be licensed, but when it's not enforced out in some parts of Minnesota, you don't end up with a licensed contractor, therefore a lot of things fall by the wayside. So let me rephrase the question. You find it in places where the building code is enforced, or more so in places where the building code isn't enforced?
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, and somehow, I think they will tell you that it is likely in cases where the code is enforced. So much of it in the metropolitan area.
Mm-hmm.
And Madam Chair, to the question, and I appreciate Representative Lucero's comments, but you need to understand that people that build apartments have a different economic interest than people that are building owner-occupied dwellings. People that build apartments are building them for themselves to own for a long period of time. I want to invest heavily in that project and the engineering in that project. When I'm selling the property, that is a different market. I'm not going to be in the ownership chain of that property. I have a different interest. And is there an ability to use less architecture or architectural controls, less engineering? I think that what you'll hear from opponents of this bill is that happens in condo projects because there's an incentive there. I want to build it, and I'm out of it. That's not the case with apartment projects where the developer and the owner are going to be in ownership of that property for a long period of time. That's another factor here that we got to remember. Apartments are different. I'm building that because I want that revenue stream off it. I want it to be quality. I don't want to maintain it, but I'm going to own it. It's a difference.
Thank you. We do have some people trickling in here. Representative Dean, was your question to Mr. Carlson or...
Well, one of them is...
Okay, yeah. Go for it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So,
Madam Chair, I'm happy to exit anytime.
So you can't exit yet. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Carlson, just to correct, oftentimes construction defects aren't the result of not following codes. I mean, sometimes it's some design flaws. Sometimes it's some actual design, the way something is constructed in detail. Just so everybody knows, the most number one problem of most buildings is around the issue of water. Water is a very damaging piece when it comes to buildings. And just to clarify, we're talking about apartments and ownership condominiums as the same. They're not the same. According to codes, oftentimes for sale condominium units have different standards of construction, whether it's sound transmission or other types of things that are different from a rental unit. So we need to be careful about how we interchange those because they're not all the same. The building codes regarding for sale units is different than the building codes for rental units. And oftentimes today, what you're seeing is some developers are believing that there may be change in some of the statutes moving forward. And there are some developers that are actually building to a for sale code, but they're using them as rental right now with the hope or the intent that in the future they might become for sale units. So this isn't a simple black and white issue. It's pretty complicated. And I just wanted to get the record that oftentimes these defects aren't related to a violation of code. You could actually be meeting the code and just have faulty construction or faulty drawing of a detail, which is a design intent that might be different. But my question also goes to the bill author. Because, as I've been... I know I'm a co-author. The 50% threshold, I'm a little bit concerned about because I'm concerned about the unit holder that has some damages that's based on some construction defect. And as was testified this morning, that person may want to bring a claim. But their responsibility is then going to be to convince the other 49% or whatever it takes them to get to 50% to actually file the claim. And their construction defect or claim may only be their unit. And so we could actually inhibit their ability to actually bring a claim related to construction defect because they're not going to be able to get their co-owners of the property to be in agreement with them. And so I'm wondering if at some point as this moves forward, having conversation on how we might be able to alleviate those situations, because they will occur. I mean, I've been in the construction industry and design industry for over 25 years. And there are times where you'll do something. It will be an installation of something that may only impact one unit. And if you're in a common ownership and the other people don't want things tied up in some type of litigation or mediation or anything that might encumber their ability to put their unit on the market, that I think we need to think a little bit more about what that says. So I guess my question, are you willing to continue to work on that to narrowly define so that that individual unit holder or that resident holder isn't left carrying the bag all by themselves?
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. As we've been working on this for 14 months that I've been involved, and there has been a lot of discussion and a lot of thoughtful consideration about that element. The version last year, you may recall, was, or at least a version at some point, was much stronger than the 50%. And we really need to, this is such a nuanced, complicated area of the law that I would expect continued discussions and trying to find the right balance in this bill. So absolutely to your question.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to this is a question to Representative Smith about Mr. Carlson's testimony. Representative Smith, was it your intention to include personal injury in this as well, or isn't it?
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, in the context that Mr. Carlson outlined, it was not the intent. So that is something that we're going to be taking a look at.
Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Mr. Carlson and you will be working on the language to ensure that that personal injury piece is carved out.
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, Mr. Carlson and I have talked about this bill at length, and we will continue to, not only with that piece, but some other parts as well.
If more witnesses don't show up, we might negotiate it right here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Mr. Carlson and Representative Smith, I am attempting to give Mr. Carlson's testifier the opportunity to get here as well, because I think that there is some additional testimony about folks who actually do this kind of litigation that is really relevant. But I, too, was very concerned, as Representative Dean just brought up, about what happens if the construction defect is really with one or two units and it's a 100-unit, facility, and many people want to sell their unit or don't want to have a lawsuit going on. And so, there are times when it is just one place where the defect happened. And so I really think that there needs to be some way when it is a small number of units to take care of this without getting so many people in the organization to have to agree, and maybe there needs to be a threshold met first before you get that enhanced number or something. I understand the concern with large numbers of suits or risk that people are afraid of being sued, but ultimately it's our constituents and it's the property that they owned, and you, Representative Smith, wouldn't want to have to get permission from your neighbor in order to sue somebody about something that was wrong with your property. And that's kind of what you're saying here. You got to get permission from not only your neighbor, but 50% of your neighborhood in order for you to sue if they did something wrong to your house. And I just think that that kind of strikes of unfair, an unfair burden if you're the only one on the block who had the defect, right? All of our houses are built very similar, right? All the houses in my neighborhood were built at the same time, and if everybody else's house was built great in my neighborhood but mine wasn't, I wouldn't want to have to get my neighbors to all agree that I should get the sue.
Representative Smith, any comment, or Mr. Carlson?
Well, Madam Chair, to that point, and I mentioned it briefly in the context of being able to bring forward a personal injury claim, but we share the concern as it relates to the homeowner claim as well. Shifting the ability to move forward with litigation away from the common interest community board and placing that with the membership. Most people will pay extra not to serve on those boards, right? This is not fun duty. People don't want to do it because they want to go on with their life. Now, the burden to get 50% of them together at an annual meeting or some special meeting to get them, there's no proxy voting. It's just not going to happen. So that structure of the bill, well, I think it's really problematic if I'm injured. Just to the whole totality of the bill is problematic as well. We, Representative Smith and I, have talked about that at some length. And if the corporate board is good enough to set pay and make decisions and borrow money, I think the homeownership board is in a good enough position to know we've got a problem and that we need to commence with some litigation. I mean, that's, to me, putting this hurdle in place wouldn't really apply in any corporate setting. If you had to get the 50% of the corporate stockholders to take an action to invest in something or borrow money, it just wouldn't work. So it's just, we need to think about what we're doing with that, and it's a pretty high hurdle.
Mr. Carlson, we have a couple of other testifiers that came in, but you're but when somebody wave at me when you're the guy that you're waiting on comes Thank in, let me know who that is. Art Burson, who is an architect, has arrived to testify. And Representative Lesh, would you like to question this? You want to hear what he has to say first?
Madam Chair, I guess I wonder what he has to say. Madam Chair, at the risk of, we've got, what, half an hour left now or something, that we can even speak on this, and the people that I want to ask questions of aren't here because of the switch around, but if the architect can speak to it, I don't know, but the developers, the mayor's made some statements that, yeah, we used to have a bunch of condos built, and now no condos have been built recently. And I thought, well, did we change the law to do something that decreased those numbers? I mean, the suggestion is that if we just prevent people's rights to access the courts or increase the burden, that somehow we're going to, a bunch of condos are going to bloom. And the best analogy I can think of, Madam Chair, is we've got budget deficits, so the solution is to put up better street signs around the Capitol so more citizens can come in and complain about the budget deficits, and that'll reduce our budget deficits. It's so far removed that I can't understand. Now, the developers sat up there and said that, yeah, and the mayor sat up there and said that, and I can't even get to Mr. Carlson's questions about the problems with the liability component of this until I'm convinced that, oh, yeah, absolutely, the reason why there's no condos is because you can sue people for building a faulty building. It makes zero sense to me. So if the architect can explain that, and here's the other thing, Madam Chair. So Mr. Johnson, the insurance guy, comes in here all the time and says, yeah, you really gotta restrict lawsuits against insurance companies. And I ask him every time, is this going to drive down insurance premiums? Every time. And every time he just says, well, I can't promise that, Representative Lesh. So why are we here then? Where is it going? So we're benefiting someone. And to me, there should be some guarantee that that's going to flip, that's going to change. So if the architect can say, yes, absolutely, you restrict people from having access to the courts for a home that they live in and bought that's faulty, and somehow we're going to build more. But I would prefer to hear that from Brad Schaefer, Carl Runk, Mayor Laufenberger, Mayor Hoagland, or Mayor Winstead, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh, I understand that Brad Schaefer is in the building. He is in the room now. So why don't we let this testifier go first if he's here, and then we'll have to bring Mr. Schaefer up.
Great, thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here. Go ahead and introduce yourself to the tape, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair of the committee. My name is Art Bartels. I'm with Bell & Swenson Graham Architects in Minneapolis. Been there 30 years, and over that time worked primarily on multifamily housing projects, condominium and apartments. We're a firm of about 115 professionals and a leader in multifamily housing, working on the again, apartments, condominiums, primarily throughout the country. I've also served in a professional role assisting homeowners associations and management companies in trying to resolve issues of maintenance or construction defects under the current laws. And I'm also a member of American Institute of Architects and speaking for the AIA of Minnesota today as well. Primarily, a great deal of care and consideration goes into condominium design. We've worked very hard on the types of detailing of walls and floors and exteriors that will suit and be meet the specific needs of multifamily housing tied together, whether it's condominium or rental. From 1992 to 2006, our firm worked on over 35 condominiums and townhome projects. However, for the past 10 years, we have worked on zero. And the primary reason for that is the current condo laws and the risks from potential lawsuits on those have raised our insurance rates and have raised the deductibles on our rates to the point where it is not affordable for us to take on that risk. We have at the same time done apartment projects over the same period of time. We've therefore had a decline in condominium projects and can only consider them where additional insurance policies are in place to offset those risks. That really drives up the price of that housing and is really limiting. It both hurts our business and drives up the cost of that housing and has really meant that we can only consider it to date on projects that are the highest luxury because they can afford that additional insurance. We believe that the proposed changes are approved. We would see more architecture firms designing condominiums again. As you heard, they're a growing need, and especially at the mid-price point level. We're trying to level the housing playing field across the types. Apartment and condominium are a lot the same. There is not specifically a different code, Ray. There's a different standard often expected in housing, depending on the price per square foot that people pay. The code is the same. And AIA would like, Minnesota would like to stress that we believe buildings shape our environment will be better designed, safer, more efficient, and more beautiful if licensed architects and working under fair contracts are involved. Thank you
for your testimony. Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Barson.
Bartels.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Bartels, I had bad information. Thank you. Okay. Mr. Bartels, this is what happens around here when it gets late. Everyone gets a little slap happy after 5 at the legislature when we're approaching bill deadlines. Okay. Mr. Bartels, you stated that the reason for that is increased lawsuits. Are you an attorney also?
Yeah.
Madam Chair and Mr. Bartels, do you have any evidence from court filings or statistics from number of filings that have increased upon which you base your assertion?
Mr. Bartels.
Madam Chair and Chairman, Representative, my opinion on that matter is based on our negotiated insurance rates going up specifically because of the condominiums that we have done.
Okay. Madam Chair, are there any Mr. Bartels, who's your insurance company?
Mr. Bartels.
Was Lloyd's of London. We're now at the different firm.
Okay. So is there, Madam Chair, is there anyone from Lloyd's of London in here? Or any insurance company that insures this kind of liability? Okay. Madam Chair, yeah, that was a rhetorical question. But Mr. Bartels, these things tend to be self-fulfilling prophecies when everyone gets in a room and says, yeah, we can't build condos because of insurance. And it's like one of those bobblehead dolls. Everyone says, yeah, that's why. Maybe I'll wait till I hear from the developer to ask the next question, Madam Chair. But I need to see some evidence that if, in fact, passing Representative Smith's bill is really going to help increase building condos, you know, I'll eat crow. Not literally, but I'll just wait on the next question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Thank you, Mr. Bartels. Mr. Schaefer, we'll bring you back up. I heard he's in the room. And then we're going to go to... Okay. Okay. So after Mr. Schaefer, we'll go with this young man that just walked through the doors. And we have roughly 30 minutes, folks, and I do want to get to Representative Omar's bill if we can, but we'll go. Go ahead.
All right. Brad Schaefer with Schaefer Richardson. I spoke this morning. I'm the developer in the room, I guess. There were a couple this morning. I guess I was the only one that managed to get over here this afternoon, so I'm available for questions.
All right. Very fine. Representative Lesh.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schaefer, did we change the law 10 years ago?
I don't think so.
Mr.
Mr. Schaefer. Representative Lesch.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schaefer, the suggestion was that there was a drop-off 10 years ago. Is your assessment similar to that? Is it 10 years ago?
Mr. Schaefer?
Drop-off in the creation of new condos,
yes.
Absolutely. And if I can back up and just give a little context to this question, if that's all right.
Yes, absolutely.
The market changed. We had a cataclysmic economic recession that started in, 2007, and it was centered in residential housing. So the supply-demand fundamentals went from very positive, I think, cooked up a little bit by the residential mortgage banking industry, if we've all seen Too Big to Fail, and we overbuilt the market, the entire country did, and so it was very much a supply-demand situation that killed the market. That also brought on a lot of unhappy homeowners that were going, boy, I overpaid for this thing, as I'm now underwater. And along comes some attorneys that said, by the way, did you know there's this law that you can sue for damages? We'll find some damages for you to, you know, we'll look around. These are all built by people. When they build anything by people, there's going to be things that are not perfect. There are defects. Sometimes they're small. Sometimes they're big. But it became, I've done 5 condo projects, and the first 3 never had a conversation. I was sued 3 times in the last 2. The difference is not the quality of the project. The difference is the timing of the project. They were developed going into the recession.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesch.
Maybe Ms. Mullen can answer this question. How old is this law that allowed for the 10 years for common interest, ownership, communities to sue based on that basis? When was that passed?
Chair and members, I don't know, but I will find out in a minute.
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think I can probably safely assume that it wasn't passed 10 years ago. So it wasn't anything that we in the legislature did to suddenly sick the lawyers on you. That law has been in place forever. And yet you're coming forward now saying, well, yeah, but you need to change it to make it even more advantageous for us now. And markets shift, absolutely, yes. I didn't see Too Big to Fail, but I saw The Big Short, and it was outrageous. I have, for most of my life, been heavily invested in real estate. I'm divesting those holdings now, but it was absolutely ridiculous and insane. I could tell an appraiser to go in and say what I needed a place appraised for, and they're like, yeah, no problem. And the prices were so incredibly inflated that people had the wrong idea about, you know, where their life savings was. But let me ask this. When you were building all these, let's back up from the 2007-2008 crash. Let's take 2002. Were you building a fair number of condos then, if you were doing it then?
Mr. Schaefer.
We started in about 2002. So we built 5 projects between 2002 and 2007.
Okay. So, Madam Chair and Mr. Schaefer, this law was still on the books then that allowed condominium communities to come forward and sue based on that, right? And it didn't discourage you from building back then, did it?
Mr. Schaefer.
No. I guess I wasn't aware of the law, but it really wasn't an issue. To your point, it wasn't an issue in 2002. It wasn't an issue in 2007. It became an issue in 2008, 9, 10, and 11 when people were looking for some sort of alleviation of their distress because they overbought. They paid for a property at the top of the market.
Representative Lesch.
Well, Madam Chair, I think that might be some of the most prescient testimony of the evening. Because, yes, the entire system was a house of cards built up all leading up to 2008. And a lot of people got really, really rich off that. I was lucky. I cashed out, took a bunch of money out, but I had other jobs, so I could afford to hold my properties. And other people that I know liquidated for pennies on the dollar. And there are some people that got out on the right side of that made a ton of money. People got on the wrong side, lost their tails on it. And Ms. Schaefer, a lot of people come in here a lot of times saying if you just change it, we'll be able to build a lot more. I'm not going to say you're a liar. That could conceivably be true. I don't know, but
there's a long line of folks that come in and say, if you just change the law, we'll start building again. And I know if I asked you, just like I ask Mr. Johnson every time, how many condos are you going to build next year if we change this law, you're not going to be able to give me an answer. You don't want to be held to that. So I'm just hard-pressed to see how – let me ask you this, Ms. Shaver. Can you give me, on a percentage of 100%, what percentage is this law the reason that you don't build condos?
Mr. Schaefer.
I've got to make up a number, of course, because I haven't thought about it quite like that. But I would have to say 70 to 80%.
Okay, 70 to 80%.
Representative Left.
And Madam Chair, since he's the only developer in here right now, that's the only person whose word I can go on. So if we were to change this, and I'll bet you Representative Smith's bill is probably going to pass this committee, and I predict it'll pass the House too, since they have a 20-vote majority this year. Congratulations. And let's say the governor signs it. Do you anticipate getting back into the condominium, townhome business again immediately?
Mr. Schaefer.
I would say this. In fact, give a really quick anecdote. Our last two multifamily rental projects that we built, we were forced by our architect and our contractor to agree contractually that if it were converted to a condo, any warranties that they would provide to us would be automatically null and void, meaning they did not want to take the risk that these projects were going to be condoed and all they were going to be susceptible to this warranty law circumstance. To answer your question, the only reason we're not the only reason, I said it's 70% of the reason, by far the most prevalent reason, as it currently stands, the only way we do a condo today with the current law is if we could do $1 million project. Projects, very high-end projects, very hard, because they have high enough margins where you can afford to pay for the extra insurance, the extra warranty reserves you have to set up with your insurer. The only way we can afford to do that is to sell very high-end condominiums at very top dollar. And we've looked at three or four projects, and none of them can we sell them at a high enough price to overcome the extra risk directly because of this the way this law has been applied by the industry over the last 10 years.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schaefer, I'm not a developer directly. I'm a partner in a development concern, and I recall the intricacies of development from the time that I worked in a local government capacity. I know a little bit about the way developers think, and it's all in numbers. Okay, that's all. Can you make the numbers work on this? Is there a gap or is there not a gap? If there is a gap, where's the gap going to come from? And one of those factors that adds the gap is the insurance piece, which you brought up. Have you heard from your insurer or insurers that if this were to change, that number would be significantly reduced enough for you to make projects like this doable?
I have not asked. I don't directly deal with the insurers, and so I have not. So no was the answer to your question. I have not, said, nor have I asked how that would affect their premiums.
Well, Madam Chair, the reason I ask, and I'll end my questioning on this, is that's a pretty important and big deal, because I know the folks who bring this bill are well intentioned, but it strikes me that there are so many pieces that need to come together to all of a sudden see what once was a dump turn into a condominium complex. And if a major part is the insurer, they're not here answering questions, say, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they'd have to bring their actuaries up, and they're not going to say anything about it. Say, yeah, absolutely, this is how we calculate it. It would come drastically down in Minnesota. I'd really want to see that, because I want to see this stuff built. That's all. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Carlson, and then we need to get to this other testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to be succinct here. Mr. Schaefer, I'll start by saying that there are definitely parts of this bill that I can appreciate and support, mainly being requiring for the maintenance plan. I think that's a great idea. But what I have concerns with, and I believe there's a question in here, is that obviously construction is a very risky business, and you assume a lot of risk, and if successful, you should be properly compensated for assuming that risk. But what I have a concern with here is, based on some of the testimony you just gave, does the legislator, does the state have a responsibility in mitigating your risk? To your comments before, in terms of the lawsuits occurred at the peak of the market. That was a risk that you assumed as a developer to proceed with the project, and that there may have been recourse on the part of some owners to seek some redress on the part of that. Why is it the legislature's responsibility in which to address or mitigate that risk?
Well, I don't
think... Mr. Schaefer.
Oh, thank you. Excuse me. I jump in.
Apologies. That's all right. You're not used to this.
For sure. You know, I don't think we're asking the legislature to mitigate our risk. We're asking them to, we perceive the system is broken. You know, a lot of things that, you know, there's a lot of things that have been around for a long time that some event happened in history that caused it from being obscure to being very relevant. And I think that's what happened to this particular piece of legislation. When, as I testified this morning, when they won't take yes for an answer, there's something wrong. That's really my point. And if that's the world we live in, insurance is a 1% of the cost, probably less than that. It's now maybe 1.5% of the cost. The cost of the premium isn't the sole thing. It's just the overriding risk. You know, it's the hours I spend in depositions. It was the mountains of paperwork we had to come up with. The point was, and we were trying to help them. Somebody talked about earlier, I walked in, I missed the first half of it, about apartments are built to a higher standard than condominiums. Well, that may be true because you're selling condos and you don't care. Well, boy, we were just the opposite. I mean, our cost per square foot for a condo was 20-30% higher than for apartments because it was much higher quality finishes, much higher quality systems, much higher quality sound attenuation, all of the above. So we built the best possible product we could afford to build at the price points we were trying to sell them at. But there is so much, there just isn't enough, it isn't worth the risk. There's we're going to get sued, we just assume that. I've entered into thousands of contracts in 30 years in the business. I've been sued 4 times on 3 projects. They're all condominiums.
Follow-up?
Just real quick. I'm familiar with your product. You do amazing work. So no disrespect with regards to that. But I think that also makes my point, is that if it's not worth the risk, why does that incentivizing need to come through legislation? Why is that not a market-driven factor in this? These laws have been in place for a long time. We had the condo booms leading up to the recession. The market was overbuilt, as we all know. So those that were seeing those trends were able to stop construction or hold off on projects and wait things out. Others moved ahead. I don't see how that lends itself to such a large swing in terms of now pushing that risk on your customers as opposed to the developer who is designing that project. It just seems like that we need to, again, there's good things in here, but I think that it goes too far. So, and there's no question there. It's just
so that was a comment. Okay, thank you. Mr. Carlson, I believe you have a testifier that has arrived, and so please take the table, the stand there, and if you could introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony, that would be great. We've got about 15-20 minutes left in committee before we have to get back to the floor. And I would really like to have Representative Omar's bill heard this evening because the treats that she brought might get stale. So we need to... Shout out to Bing Freshman.
Unless my bill is hurt and there's no eating.
Representative Johnson?
I see an email that they're going to reconvene at 6.
At 6. So, yeah, I said we have about 15-20 minutes.
Right.
Welcome to the committee. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, honorable members of the committee, thank you very much for making time to hear my comments this afternoon. My name is Will Rogers. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. Brief bit of background, I have been a construction defect litigator focused on multifamily, townhome, condominium defect cases. For 6 years, I have worked as an insurance defense lawyer representing developers and builders. And then for the most recent 6 years, I have represented the homeowners associations in the same type of claims. I've given several continuing legal education seminars on topics affecting construction defect matters, specifically in common interest communities under the MCIOA. I mean, I've lived with this statute for a long time. I'm here today to try and address one seemingly small but I think very significant proposed change to the current statute. And the language that I'm focused on is found at in House File 1538, Section 7, lines 19.11 to 19.12, a single sentence. The change proposed would be a modification of the fee and cost shifting provision that currently exists in the Common Interest Ownership Act, and for convenience I'll just refer to it as the MCIOA or 515B. Why not just use 515B because we're short on time. That fee shifting provision is really rooted in two principles, equity and incentives. On the equity side, that's just about our sense of fairness. Home buyers in a common interest community, unlike home buyers who buy a single family home and contract directly with the builder for the construction and everything else, people who aren't buying finished products, everyone in a common interest community is buying after the construction is completed. They don't have an opportunity to contract to have a role in how the building itself on the exterior is assembled or put together. It's all done without any input from those people. The buyers typically come along long after the construction is complete. And for that reason, we think it, in the law, unfair to burden those buyers with a share of fees and costs to remedy defective construction that is solely and exclusively within the control of the builder and developer. And moving on to incentives, the incentives of this fee-shifting provision are to, one, discourage frivolous claims, two, to force attorneys to select and pursue only claims that might be meritorious, three, to encourage efficient use of legal resources once a case is in suit, and fourth, to promote early settlement when that might be possible between the parties. The current section is a prevailing party provision. It's reasonably fair and equitable insofar as it doesn't discriminate between builder developer on one side and homeowner or homeowners association on the other. The winner is rewarded for bringing a meritorious claim. The loser is tagged with the opposing side's attorney fees and costs. And that fits in with the fundamental purpose of the statute itself. A separate section of 515B expressly says the remedies provided in this chapter shall be administered so as to put the prevailing party in a position that they would have been in had the offending party fully performed. It benefits the winner. It doesn't play favorites. Rewards meritorious claims, penalizes frivolous claims, as well as frivolous defenses. And those are important considerations. The amendment that's proposed, that one additional sentence, seeks to leave this fair and equitable provision in place for every type of claim that would arise under 515B, except construction defect claims. As proposed, the amendment looks like it's really nothing more than a special interest carve-out intended to benefit developers and their insurance carriers at the expense of innocent homeowners that the statute is intended to protect. And why do I use the term innocent homeowners? Because we've already established you are only able to access the fee and cost shifting provision if you bring a meritorious claim. You have to win. And if the homeowners association brings a claim and they lose, they have to pay the developer's fees and costs. And that does have an important impact on the incentives available. Construction defect claims are probably the most time-consuming and expensive claims that a homeowners association is likely to ever have to undertake. These cases can go on for 18 months, 24 months, sometimes as long as 3 years. The cost to litigate on both sides, defendants and plaintiffs, can approach one-third to up to one-half of the actual cost of repair that's ultimately determined. Part of it is because the number of parties can be really large. In a large project, you may be dealing with a developer entity, a general contractor entity, an architect, and 18 to 20 subcontractors all involved in the same litigation, lining up against the homeowners association. When the costs get that out of balance to the repairs that are necessary, the litigation costs, that is, a prevailing party fee provision allows the homeowners to be made whole and ensures that they will have sufficient funds available to make their repairs at the end of the day. Because, again, this is a prevailing party statute. The proposed change undermines the consumer protection purpose of the statute, and it undermines the buyer protection purpose of the section of the statute that it appears in. The proposed change undermines the interest of equity. It's unfair to burden owners with litigation costs to remedy problems that they could have had no role in helping to prevent. The proposed change also undermines the incentives. It removes first a working check on frivolous claims, or at least speculative claims, and it encourages parties to try and litigate their opponent into the ground. So if you have one party who has lots of money and financial resources, maybe a party backed by an insurance carrier paying their bills, they can simply continue to draw out the litigation and litigate the association into the ground until they just say uncle. At some point they have to give up because they're not going to be able to make the repairs. And I can give you examples of how this works out in real practice. In December, I received a call from a prospective client homeowners association. I consulted with them on the telephone. I went and took a look at their property. They had already engaged an engineer who had taken parts of the buildings off and had found some pretty significant damage, sheathing you could literally put your finger through. And they wanted to find out whether or not they should try and pursue the developer for the defect claims that they had just discovered. One of the main considerations that we took into account and that I advised them on at the meeting was that, look, you have to be pretty sure that your odds are significantly better than 50-50 before pursuing this claim. Otherwise, this is how long the cases last. This is how much they cost. In your case, it will be, you know, roughly X dollars to complete the initial litigation investigation. And if you don't prevail, the other side's fees and costs are going up at the same rate. You'll have to pay me, you'll have to pay them, and will that leave you enough money to make repairs if you're not going to win? They consulted with their engineer. Their engineer couldn't make a guess better than a coin flip that they were likely to be able to prove that the defects that they found were the builder's fault. And considering that, the board opted not to proceed with litigation. They opted to save their money, put it into repairs to their property. It serves as an effective check on litigation, and that's an issue I haven't heard raised yet to this committee today. And it's a consideration that should be brought in, because if this amendment is adopted, you may find that you have an unintended consequence of additional lawsuits that previously would have been weeded out before anyone knew they might exist. From the other side, from having worked as defense counsel for builders and developers, I can tell you that I advised my builder and developer clients, and through them, their insurance carriers, of the indemnity risk involved in a common interest community lawsuit under 515B, where if the plaintiff during the investigation uncovered damages and they were likely to recover, the builder was going to get tagged with fees and costs, which meant the insurance carrier was going to have to pay him. And we had plenty of communications back and forth about whether or not the obligation that arises under the statute is within the coverage provided by the policy. It is. the standard form commercial general liability policy that is typically provided to builders and developers does cover liabilities arising out of statute, so long as those liabilities arise out of an occurrence within the definition of that policy. So these are insured risks. They're not risks that the developer or the builder bears on their own. It's not money out of their own pocket. If they have insurance for the claim, they also have insurance for the attorney fee obligation that might arise if that claim is in fact meritorious. And again, it sounds like a broken record, but a meritorious claim for the Homeowners Association means we found defects and damage, and the developer's going to have to pay to fix them because they broke it in the first place. They should be responsible for it. Like I mentioned, now that I work for associations, I do advise all of my clients at the very outset of the case of the potential risk that they may be obligated for opposing party fees, and therefore it's important to do a significant and thorough investigation pre-suit whenever possible to make sure that we can assess their likelihood of recovery. It is an effective gatekeeper. Also, the ability to recover fees and costs helps ensure that the total recovery that a homeowners association gets is enough to make the needed repairs, make them whole, and help avoid special assessments. And avoiding special assessments for acute repairs to damage caused by defective construction is very significant. The target market principally for condominiums and especially townhomes that are built in the Twin Cities metro area are first-time home buyers, young home buyers with families, young children, and retirees, people who are tired of living in a single-family home, don't want the headache and hassle, want to move to something smaller, downsize, if you will. But also, they're no longer necessarily employed. They're typically fixed income. These are people with the least flexibility in their monthly budgets to absorb something like a special assessment that might be taken out in order to make repairs. So for those folks, it's a big deal. And I heard testimony earlier today about how homeowners can be burdened even though they don't feel like their own property is involved in a construction defect claim. But that's a complicated assessment to make depending on whether you're talking about a homeowners association that has a townhome-style community where you have a unit owner owning their separate unit but sharing maybe some elements of the property on the exterior in common, a condominium where all the owners own the entire exterior of the building all the way to the interior finishes in common, undivisible. It's not so clear. There's a reason that the Common Interest Ownership Act is different from 327A, the standard new home warranty statute. It's because the mix of property interests is significantly different, and the MCIOA is an attempt to manage the separation of the bundle of sticks of property ownership between each individual unit owner, the things they hold separately, the things that they hold jointly in common, and the things for which their association either owns among all of them or at least has maintenance obligations that have to be performed. It's a far more complicated scenario than a single-family home. And the field of play is much greater. And by greater, I mean if I have to go investigate claims that may relate to a 250-unit property, I'm going to have to spend $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 just on engineering costs to develop the claims and determine whether or not we have an issue that should be pursued in order to bring it all the way to trial and get the developer to come to the table. One of the incentives, I think I've glossed right past it, is that once a case goes into litigation, the current fee-shifting provision serves as a reality check on all the litigants. It encourages parties who can already see that they're likely to lose to come to the table, make a reasonable offer, settle the case at the earlier rather than the later opportunity. If you remove the ability of homeowners associations to seek recovery of those fees and costs, again, these claims cost between 10 and 50 times as much to litigate, then we're going to end up with homeowners associations in a disadvantaged position where the developer can simply, even if they don't have a meritorious defense, well, they don't have to worry about it. They can bury him. And the developer is being funded by the carrier.
Thank you. We do have a couple of, or at least one member question. Representative Lunin?
Madam Chair, I'll pass.
Oh, okay. Representative Johnson?
I'll pass.
You'll pass as well? Okay. Other member questions? Representative Lesch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Smith, Ms. Mullen helped me out a little bit in looking at when some of the laws were written that enabled the common interest ownership actions. And depending on which statute you pick, it's anywhere from the mid-70s to the early 90s. And yet, Mr. Schaefer got into it in, about 15 years ago, which apparently the market was palatable or was good, and you don't get into a business unless you can make money off it. So with these laws on the books for anywhere from, prior to the crash, 15 years to 35 years, there was no issue with it before that. It strikes me that the major issue, and this was attested to by Mr. Schaefer, was the crash. And yet, we're not really addressing that. We're addressing something that has been on the books for decades and has not been an issue. So why would you say that your legislation is going to be the fix that's going to turn this problem around?
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think an element that hasn't been discussed too much yet in regard to this is the increased claims that have come in the ninth year of the development process. And I think that if you look at those and from a historical perspective, I think that is a contributing factor. I think in part explain why the laws have been in place since the 70s up through the 90s. So that's a factor. I mean, it's very similar to the ADA law that we talked about last session, and I hope we're going to be able to talk about next week about how a law can be in place for a certain amount of time, and you don't realize the impact in the market until there's people file suits underneath those sections of the law, and then you have these resulting, the resulting impact in the market. I think that is a part of this.
Well, Madam Chair, so on that ADA law, we had this bozo going around filing what was clearly frivolous lawsuits just as a profit center. I mean, for those folks that wanted to have the ADA law an available tool to address actual problems, I mean, Mr. Carlson and other folks came forward to try to reach a deal on that thing, because we knew, okay, this is not the way it was intended to be applied. But I haven't heard any similar kinds of things in this case where, just because it's the ninth year, these lawsuits came forward. No one has suggested to me that they were frivolous or illegitimate or something. I mean, one testimony came forward saying, well, they sued for the windows and the stucco, and then they didn't change the windows and the stucco. I'm sure I can see how that would be frustrating, but it may or may not get to the core of what's going to allow for more condos to be built. So I just have some problems with the suggestions by the testifiers, not with your bill per se, but somehow this bill is going to be the panacea. And suddenly we're going to build more condos. And in order to get there, we have to bulldoze some legitimate access to justice issues by individuals. And what I can't figure out is one of the earlier testifiers who had said, a condo association is essentially a corporation. And I would eat my shorts if I saw anyone of you on the other side of the aisle suggest that two-thirds of shareholders of a corporation have to vote in order to take legal action. Am I wrong?
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, there's no interest in the short aspect eating that, but I am interested in eating one of the Representative Omar's cookies.
What a dodge.
So I would be... and in regard to the ADA law, I'm sensitive to the time because I know that there's probably some other comments and such that want to be made.
Okay, I'll shut up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam.
Other member questions? Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to acknowledge our testifier. Appreciate for shining a light on some of the issues that were not previously discussed, and we'll be obviously taking that into consideration, so thank you.
Representative Smith, you get the last word.
Madam Chair, members, I appreciate the thoughtful discussion, all of the co-authors, and I look forward to continuing this discussion. I ask for your support this evening. Thank you.
Thank you. All those in favor of House File 1538 as amended, being sent to their general register, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Smith. Representative Omar, we're going to try to sneak it in.
I know.
Representative Omar, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope you guys will enjoy the cookies that I brought. They've been patiently waiting to be eaten.
Thank you for being a dutiful freshman.
Thank you. I move House File 1701 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much. To your bill.
Madam Chair, House File 1701 just creates a clarification, and it clarifies that the current data that is classified as private and non-public to be classified and have that data not apply to when a government entity employee or a contractor it's been a long day accesses it and it's not treated the same as when you access a government data.
Thank you. And do you have a testifier?
And I do have. I have two gentlemen testifying on behalf of the bill who know a lot but do not like to be referred to as experts.
All right. Mr. Gimberly, why don't you introduce yourself at the tape? Go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Don Gimberly. I'm with the Coalition on Government Information and, among other things, sort of the resident historian of the Data Practices Act. Several years ago, you dealt with the issue of electronic cookies. Actually, somebody's getting cookies.
They're not electronic.
But they're not electronic. Cookies are things that people can put on your computer when you visit their website. And the question is whether or not the government ought to be in the business of putting cookies on people's computers. And the answer is because of most of the software that government buys, cookies are part of the deal. So you decided the public had the right to know that cookies were being placed on their computers when they access government sites. But at some point, somebody raised the issue of how should we classify that data, the data that records whether or not you were there, that sort of thing. And you decided to make that data private or non-public if it was data sent by a company. Later on, in an entirely different context, after you adopted that position, the question came up in connection with whether or not a public employee who accessed data, whether or not in this particular instance probably improperly accessed data, whether or not what you did in this section trumped what's done in the personnel data section. Because the personnel data section says when somebody is charged with a complaint or charged under law or personnel policies, the public has a right to know what's going to happen to that person. So that interpretation essentially used this section to trump the personnel data section, therefore keeping what would normally be public, not public. And so when we thought about whether or not it ought to work that way, we didn't think that's the way you really wanted things to work, and that's what Representative Omar is trying to fix. Just clarify that this applies to citizens, companies. It doesn't apply to computer access by public employees.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that was just testifying? Mr. Neumeister?
Honorary.
Madam Chair, for the record, it's also very much clear is that it's very important because in the paper files, when folks, all the information that government has on us, you generally have a right under data practices to be able to see who looks at your kid's file.
if there's an audit log or whatever. Under this law, it's also been interpreted not to apply for electronic files. So let's say with all the data going on electronic files and things like that, that you have a right as a person to look at your own data. You could say, nope, you're not going to find out who's going to look at your kid's file. You're not going to look, you know, what you already have a right under with paper. So it's also on that part of clarification.
Thank you. Any member questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, Representative Omar, you get the final word.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your support. I renew my motion to include for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you very much. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Thank you.
Oh, that's right. We don't vote on this. It's being laid over. With that, we're adjourned. Race over to the Capitol, folks. Thank you.